Okay. Everybody knows me, I think. I'm Tandava. Everybody knows what class you're in, I hope. The yugas. Yay. So, some people have already read this book, and I will try not to bore you too much, but because this is targeted at people who haven't read this book, because this book is what I know. and so this is written by Joseph Selby, also known as Purushottama, and David Steinmetz, also known as Vyasa, both formerly of the village, Ananda Village, but not there anymore, neither of them. Pura is, I think. And they spent decades researching this kind of stuff and putting together this fantastic book, which is a great read, and I highly recommend it. Pretty much everything I'm going to talk about comes out of this, but there's even more in here. So if you enjoy this, that's where you go. And a lot of these slides are from Purushottama also. So this is where it all started, with Swami Sri Yukteswar, who was, of course, the guru of Yogananda. There he is, up on the right-hand side of the altar. This was his book, The Holy Science. This is what the current edition of it looks like. And the part about the yugas, this book isn't actually about the yugas. The introduction has a few pages on the yugas, the cycles of time. And it just points out the general outline. So from which I said, these guys went and just researched all the evidence about it that would fit in with that to show us how it all works. So So the basic concept is, we're going to start on a galactic scale. This is an artist's rendering of a binary star system. I have no idea what they actually look like. But most stars in the universe, it seems, are actually not just hanging out there all by themselves, but are part of a pair that orbit around each other, or maybe a smaller set like this. And what... So you can imagine, and then all the stars are gathered into a galaxy, right? And then there are galaxies throughout the universe. So just bigger and bigger piles of stars. But within this galaxy, maybe these two stars are going to be orbiting around each other, but also they're sort of orbiting like this around inside the whole galaxy. Does that kind of make sense? And so what Sri Yukteswar tells us is that the center of the galaxy is a great, great source of energy. And he presents it as spiritual energy. I think there's some evidence for some form of high radiation type of energy that people are able to detect. But there's a lot of energy in the center. And as these two stars are going around like this, around the center of the galaxy, sometimes our star is going to be closer to the center of the galaxy, and sometimes it's going to be farther away as they're doing this, as they go around. And we feel those effects on planet Earth has increased energy. Yes?
Sorry, I just wanted some clarity about this. So, in our Milky Way galaxy, the Sun is one of the two binary stars.
Right, and
and
have...
what's the other one?
We do not know.
Okay.
And in the book, they actually suggest the possibility that maybe it isn't a literal one, maybe it's just on an elliptical orbit, and referring to... Sri Yukteswar talks about our Sun's dual. And they say maybe that's just a colorful way of referring to the other point of the elliptic. I forget what you call it. There's sort of two points of an ellipse, just to represent how it's not going in a perfect circle as it orbits around the galaxy. So we're not sure, but there is astronomical evidence that I can't really talk about from my knowledge that it could very well have a dual that we just haven't been able to figure out yet. So anyway, this is happening, and as our solar system, and therefore our planet, gets closer to this galactic center, the source of spiritual energy, we receive that energy on Earth, and it affects our lives. Just whenever you're, just like our lives are affected when we're around a high-energy person like any of these gurus or Swami Kriyananda, it's just sort of for the whole planet that's happening. And human consciousness changes and just expands greatly into that energy. And as we move away, we lose that. Yogananda said, environment is stronger than willpower. Well, here it is on the biggest scale we've got. our solar system's location relative to the galactic energy just changes civilization completely.
That statement has a lot of gravity to it.
It does, thank you. Another little interesting thing is the precession of the equinoxes, which some people may have heard of. Our planet sort of tilts around over the centuries a little bit, and so which constellations are in the sky at a particular time will sort of very gradually change over all the years. And I don't know how this necessarily relates to our position relative to the galactic center, but what's interesting is that nowadays people think it will take about 26,000 years for to make a full cycle and come back to its original orientation. And Sri Yukteswar said the entire cycle of the yugas takes about 24,000 years. There are also people today who think that the rate isn't entirely constant, which could mean that plus Sri Yukteswar's about could have it. Maybe these are things that line up. Anyway, there's some cycle going on here that this is also a part of. Okay. We've probably all, even before we heard about the yugas, at least Westerners have probably heard the Greek idea of the Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age. So there's four of those, and there are four different yugas. And actually, it wasn't just the Greeks and the Indians, it was cultures all around the world. So in ancient Persia, the Zoroastrians, they talked about a cosmic year that spanned 12,000 years and had four ages, which would, of course, be half of the circle, and divided into four periods. The Norse myths talked about an age of peace, an age of the development of social orders, an age of increasing violence, and a degraded age of cruel winters and moral chaos, ending in annihilation called Ragnarok. Luckily, we don't go quite there. We keep going in a cycle. The Celts had a similar tradition of the ages, and they talked, they assigned colors to these. Let's see, where are they? Which were white or silver, red or bronze, golden or yellow, and black. And those are interesting because they actually match up with the traditional colors assigned to the yugas in the Indian tradition. In Egypt, they talk about an age when an age of gods, an age of demigods, an age of heroes, and an age of ordinary men. Again, four things that we cycle through. The Hopi Indians in America have this tradition of these ages when the white buffalo stands on all four legs, solid and grounded, or when he's only standing on three legs, or when he's only standing on two legs, or when he's trying to balance on one leg and everything's just up in the air, which lines up perfectly with something from the yugas tradition where they talk about the bull of Dharma doing the same thing. And when the bull of Dharma is standing on four legs, Dharma in mankind is fully developed. And when it's standing on one leg, we're barely hanging on. So it's just interesting, a very similar image there. So let's see.
So which of these is like the darkest? The one-legged buffalo.
Kali Yuga at the bottom. And we're going to go through them all individually. Okay. But here's the outline. And we like to study the yugas because it's sort of the best preserved and the most detailed, especially because we have relatively recent gurus outlining it for us. And then this is, of course, the perspective that these guys took when they wrote their book. One thing Yukteswar did was he corrected some inaccuracies because we've recently come out of the lowest age when mankind gets confused about a lot of things, including actually the yugas. And somewhere in the past couple thousand years, probably, some calculations started creeping into people's studies. And there's, I think, maybe still a school of thought that thinks that we're going to be in Kali Yuga for another 400,000 years, which is like, oh, boy, kill me now.
That's still a standard teaching in India.
Yeah.
If you teach us to Indians, they get bothered by that, because that's what they've been told. So.
Yeah. But I think we'll see that the evidence really supports where our gurus say we are in this cycle. But Yukteswar pointed out, hey, we've made this error, and here's how to correct it. So anyway, the full cycle takes 24,000 years. Another inaccuracy that has crept in some traditions is to think that you sort of go from, I think it was from the highest age down to the lowest age, and then boom, you just get to start right up at the top again, which we may all be desperate for, but that isn't actually how anything in nature works, right? Everything happens gradually. And so the cyclical view really makes a lot more sense. You can see the little dotted line there. That's our "you are here" line. Sorry, we're still pretty far down to the beginning. So it's 12,000 years up, 12,000 years down. The technical bottom point, I think, was actually 499, but we tend to just round things off, so it's a little easier to look at all the numbers. The Kali Yuga is 1,000 years, and it has 100 years of transition on either side, so you can think of it as 1,200 years. Dwapara is 2,000 years and has 200 years of transition on either side, so it's 2,400 years. And they go up like that. Treta is 3,000 or 3,600 with the transitions, and Satya Yuga is 4,000 or 4,800 years with the transitions. And of course, Satya Yuga, then you get, after ascending Satya Yuga, you get to go into descending Satya Yuga, which is still pretty good. So I find it actually really encouraging that this is so weighted towards the top. You know, so if you know, if the bull of Dharma is on one leg down here and it's on two legs here, you could sort of say, by this point, we're already halfway to fully developed Dharma. And we get to spend just proportionally a lot more time in the nicer...
That's 2,000 years from now.
These are still very long periods of time, yes.
I think we're still going to be here.
Well, not in these particular bodies.
Okay. So it's conceivable that we've had incarnations in Satya Yuga, and for some reason...
Oh, it's entirely conceivable. But we may not have. So,
yeah.
You know, there isn't only this planet either. And, you know, Master said there are tons of planets to incarnate. In fact, if you kept coming back to the same one, you'd figure it out too quickly, is what he said. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Let me figure it out. But there are many, many other planets. And I would have to imagine that some of them would be by default just closer to the galactic center and get to spend, like, maybe their bottom point of Kali Yuga isn't so relatively bad. Maybe it's all just variations of Satya Yuga on that planet. And maybe there's some planets that are so far out that they barely ever get out of Kali Yuga. And there are others like ours, which kind of get a bit of everything. So we can incarnate all sorts of different places. And if we're ready to incarnate and Earth is in Satya Yuga and we can't handle that yet, we'll just go somewhere else. And now everybody on the planet at any given time is, of course, not exactly at the same developmental level. We can just look around and see that. But overall, there's kind of a center of gravity for the consciousness of the planet. And some people will be below it, maybe because they just need to fight it, or they need to be pulled upward by that energy. Some people would be above it because they're trying to come back and help us. I mean, all these guys, Satya Yuga consciousness, but they came at this time to help us. So, you know, and all of us, being consciously aware of it, are really trying to, you know, raise ourselves individually to a higher level, which we can, but we are kind of working in this context, which really affects us, so we need to understand it. One thing that's been said is that the lifespan of man in Kali Yuga is, call it 100 years, which is obviously kind of the extreme, but people could conceivably live to 100 years. Dwapara, 200. Treta, 300. Satya, 400. And again, that may be an extreme, and it's clearly not happening right now in Dwapara Yuga, but we've seen people live to 120. And, you know, in another 2,000 years of this age, you know, maybe, you know, the 200-year-old people, that won't be so unusual. And Treta and Satya, you know, anything goes. There, So these guys at the top and the bottom are right next to each other, but these here are sort of mirror images, you know, Dwapara descending and Dwapara ascending. And, you know, there will be similarities if you're living here in Dwapara with what was going on in the world, you know, at this corresponding part here in Dwapara. Similarities, but not exactly the same, because in one, you're moving upward, and you'll pass through similar points, but going in a different direction. In the other one, you're moving downward. And in this class, we'll sort of go around the full cycle and take a look at it and see some, you know, as much as we can guess or extrapolate or whatever, how these things relate. Yeah, and the authors of this book make the point that when you start looking at all of history just from this perspective of human consciousness and this overall development and devolution on the other side of consciousness, a lot of things make a lot of sense that don't necessarily make as much sense if you're just trying to look at history and figure it out, assuming it's all been a straight line from of progress from cavemen to us. All right, so we're going to start at the bottom, Kali Yuga. And so they're the two of them next to each other. So we actually have to go through 2,400 years of Kali Yuga in one go, going down and then coming back up again, but that's two ages there. And some words to describe sort of the consciousness of people in Kali Yuga might be passive, fatalistic, Purushottama talks about them being almost willfully ignorant. There were times in this period, because this is where we have recorded history, you know, so we can actually look at it, when, you know, the Great Library of Alexandria burned and lost all that information. Barbarians would sweep across the country and destroying things, and you know monks would hide books away in their monasteries to try and preserve anything from the ravaging hordes. There was a time, let's see, when was this? Maybe a few hundred years B.C., Emperor Qin Shi Huang Ti of China had all the books in China burned. That's probably a lot of books. So this kind of thing was going on. People really depended heavily on their senses to understand reality. You couldn't get very abstract. So it's like, is it in front of me? Can I see it? Can I hear it? Can I touch it? That's a definition of what is real. And in this book, they actually give these little formulas for the ages, which are kind of nice. Sort of like, here's your formula for how to make a Kali Yuga person. Passive acceptance, dull-mindedness, and matter awareness. That's kind of how their consciousness is structured. And then this will give us like a handy little thing to compare to the other yugas as we go up.
Can you go back? There were some good bullets on that. Yep.
And a couple of these we're actually going to see a little bit more of in a minute.
Okay.
Rulers, yep.
The characters kind of sound like the normal American.
Yeah, sorry.
Not spiritual.
See that dotted line? See how close we still are to Kali Yuga? that's where we are now. We're not far out of Kali Yuga. And like I was saying, Dwapara Yuga doesn't only contain people with Dwapara consciousness. You still have somewhat of a range of individuals. And we're actually still kind of transitioning. So technically, Kali Yuga would have ended in 1700, and the first 200 years to up to 1900 were not even technically Dwapara. It was just a transition phase. So we've really only had 100 out of our 2,000 years of Dwapara Yuga. We have a lot of development still to go in this yuga.
You know, when I moved here, there was no internet.
Oh my gosh, how Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, rulers tended to be hereditary. You know, I'm king because my father was king. And so, again, that's a very sort of matter awareness, just like what can we observe? Like, okay, this royal couple gave birth to this kid, that must be the new king. They tend to be very self-serving and just low consciousness. Again, there's a variation, but that was the general trend. Whoops. There is also this, so this is sort of a picture zooming in on the very bottom of that circle, just showing the Kali Yugas and showing us how some things kind of form mirror images. Because there was this period when in Kali Yuga, when you're coming into an age of matter awareness where everybody just wants to build a bigger kingdom and just get stuff together, because that's what you're thinking of, land and stuff and conquest. And there was this period, you know, going into Kali Yuga from the previous age of energy, when there was what they call the consolidation of empires. You know, there's Persia, there's India, there's China, there's Julius Caesar in Rome, really building their empires. But really at the bottom, everything's falling apart because we're trying to be matter focused, but our consciousness is just so low that we're just messing everything up and deciding it's more fun to destroy matter than build things up. But coming out of it again, Kali Yuga is still matter focused, but it's rising, and we're starting to build things again. And okay, let's actually get a functioning kingdom or empire or something here together. So there's Genghis Khan, there's the Catholic Church, there's Charlemagne, like all these different ways you can look at it, but people trying to put things together and have a bigger range of influence that wasn't just completely falling apart. There, down at the bottom, we have things like the Mayan collapse, the fall of Rome, all of these things. And these charts are in the book also, if you get the book. I don't have a slide for the religions, but you know, many of the religions we know today did exist in Kali Yuga. The way they were practiced, they would tend to be very ritualistic, because people can look at something that they do physically and relate to that. Priests would often be hereditary, like rulers, so there could be that kind of a caste system. Things could be very dogmatic and fixed. You have to do what we say because I'm the priest, because my father was a priest, so just shut up and do it. That kind of consciousness.
So the Christ's birth was right during the dissension.
Yeah, he was.
So that was a tough time.
Yeah, but avatars come even at the lowest points. Thank goodness. But look what happened to him. You know, he came at a time when if people didn't like you, they nailed you to a cross until you died. You know, we've come a little bit of a way since then. And they didn't like him because he was trying to say, you are all sons of God. But thank goodness, avatars still try to come and help us out even in those times.
And was it, I heard that Yukaswar's theory wasn't really that well embraced around
the what?
His theories of the Yugas seemed a little, didn't people like throw rocks at him or something? Because this is ridiculous, or did I misread
Jesus?
That? No, you push far.
Well, he was trying to correct people, you know, because there, like Chris was saying, there are a lot of people who still say, wait, no, our calculations say we have another 400,000 years of Kali Yuga. So whenever you do that, there's going to be some head butts. But, you know, the evidence will support this view.
You know, one thing that I think is amazing is Christ had it bad, right? So he was getting that. But then his disciples
had even worse.
He came in and gave this burst.
That had to carry it through the worst part.
Yeah, and then, you know, all of disciples and all the people that carried Christianity.
The lowest point is about 500 AD, and it was Christianity really took off was about 300 AD, mm-hmm. and they had to go through all the martyrs and throwing Christians to the lions, that kind of thing. Wow. So that's bottom Kali Yuga.
That's in there.
Yeah.
Of course, even Christianity was in a very material focused. It was starting to be aligned with government and power and the empire.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Rather than
yeah, that's why they were listed.
Connection.
That's why the Catholic Church is listed as one of those empires.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
the symbol is always the physical cross. You know, Jesus, like this, he said, the inner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Consciousness
too.
Yeah.
There are some parallels of philosophy in the Renaissance, which we have on the left side there at the end of Kali Yuga ascending. A lot of them were actually very consciously looking back towards the Golden Age, what we call the Golden Age, not Satya Yuga, but since they didn't have the concept of the Yugas, they called this the Golden Age of Greece because they knew about their philosophy and could start to understand it and admire it again and base a lot of what they were doing on those teachings, which had sort of gotten, you know, either lost or forgotten or ignored during all that downward time. But if you line these up according to the lengths of time in Kali Yuga, that stage of sort of philosophical awareness, interest, thought, they actually line up to the corresponding parts of these yugas.
Even those philosophers thought that they were descended from a that they were in a descended age. You know, there was greater thought prior to themselves that had been lost.
Yeah, and this is something that we usually mention when we're coming, we've gone around the cycle and are coming back down, but when we look at these historical thinkers like these Greeks, most of the traditions around the world really say, like, you know, we may be okay now, but we used to be really great. Our ancestors were great thousands of years ago. That's when people really knew what was going on, and we're just doing our best. At this point, we can only look back that far. You know, and now, you know, we feel a sense of progress because we're on an upward swing. But all those people that we know about who are coming down, they remembered, like, we don't really remember what we were doing, but we knew it was better than this. So that's kind of a hint there as well.
So the Dark Ages, when people talk about the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, then, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you mean, because Middle Ages is probably sort of mostly in here. And sometimes I think people might use Dark Ages to refer to that. You know, if we're talking about yugas, we would probably call this the darkest time because it's right at the bottom.
Well, in European perspective, we would call that bottom book, you know, the medieval period.
Yeah, I guess it probably goes down almost to the bottom. Is that considered medieval? I don't know the exact dates of that. You notice Galileo and Copernicus are over there on the side. The whole concept of the Earth moving around the Sun rather than vice versa was also something from the ancient Greeks, and where it says sun centrism versus earth centrism, that's kind of when things were shifting. You know, when they understood it, to people coming back down to, well, here's the earth I'm standing on, this must be the center of the universe because I'm fixated on matter, and so everything else must go around it. But at the equivalent spot coming back up, these guys started figuring it out again. There are also various mechanical devices. So they have like water wheels and windmills and things like that that were in use a long time ago, disappeared for a while at the very bottom, and then came back in again at approximately the same level on the upward swing. So we just have all these fun little mirror images. Okay, I think any questions about Kali Yuga, or do we want to just get the heck out of it?
Well, I think it's cool to see that, you know, Galileo and Copernicus were starting to understand that the Sun was the center of our solar system, you know, right around the same time. That's really fascinating to think of that.
Yeah,
so.
And this is a theme, you know, I mean, not even across yugas, but even just, you know, at any given time period, discoveries will often happen simultaneously. Like, you can go for centuries without knowing about something, and then two people will discover it at the same time in completely different places. Darwin's theory of evolution was almost, who was the other guy, do you remember?
Wallace's
theory of evolution, except Darwin published a couple weeks before him. They're both coming up with this on their own, and there are many things like that, because as the energy to the planet increases as the overall population's spiritual awareness and mental energy increases, people start being able to be aware of the same things, and so multiple people are going to notice the same kind of things. Lots of achievements work that way. For ages it was assumed that nobody could run a mile under 4 minutes, and then Roger Bannister, was that his name, did it some decades ago, I don't remember when, and now, the top runners are probably expected to run a mile in under 4 minutes because that's what's done, and more people can do it. Just a couple weeks ago, somebody for the first time ran a marathon in under 2 hours. Those are like 14 miles an hour for 26.2 miles. Whew. But you can bet that more people are going to start doing that because energy, it's even physical, I guess. It's not even just spiritual energy, but once people start accomplishing things, it's really happening everywhere. Everybody's being uplifted, and we'll see more of them.
When I was younger, I studied with a woman named Kali Ray. And I think of the goddess Kali's having all these goals around her.
Oh,
it's
Kali.
Like, why would somebody want that name? Satya Ray or something would be what I want. Yeah.
Kali, yeah, that's interesting, because Kali is one of the forms of the Divine Mother.
The word means dark.
It means dark. Yeah. But also, the mother is the parent that actually makes us out of her own body, who gives us a physical life. And so, if it's going to relate to any of them, relating to the level of matter might make sense. I mean, we have God as a Trinity. There's God the Father completely outside of everything, and Mother, which is actually, Om vibrating through us, actually creating our bodies. And then there's the Son, which is the consciousness of the Father in that, even in the creation of the Mother. But the Mother is in charge of the actual creation, so that's why Kali is there.
She's the appropriate Mother Goddess for Kali Yuga.
Yeah, and we wouldn't even have a planet to have yugas on if we didn't have Divine Mother to create it for us. So there it is. And, she's got the garland of skulls and everything because, that's the material world for you if we're on it. Even in Satya Yuga, things end, people die eventually. It's just, that's what happens with creation.
I had a question about the descending and the ascending. Mm-hmm. Where has there ever been a corresponding phenomenon like the internet?
Well, so that's going to be tricky because, like I was saying, even if you're at the same spot, things can look very different going up than coming down. And when we do the downward cycle, so right now, after we've talked about Kali Yuga, we're going to go up the upside, and then we're going to come down the downside. And we'll sort of see how they look different.
It just seems to me like the internet could accelerate everything because there's never been worldwide communication before.
Yeah, so we're in Dwapara Yuga next.
So
this,
we'll get to that.
Well, it does accelerate things, and it does facilitate communication, and we're in Dwapara Yuga now, so we can have things like the internet.
But there's never been worldwide communication, is it?
Right.
Maybe the faulty assumption.
Right.
It doesn't accelerate what happens in that age. The age is still constant.
I mean, well, it is what happens. It's part of
what happens
in the age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
I guess my theory is that it could really, there could be an explosion of intelligence, of spirituality very quickly now, because it's all getting out.
Some extent there has been,
right.
And there probably will be even more, because we're still so early in Dwapara Yuga, but we're in Dwapara Yuga here now, so let's see what we've got. So, Dwapara Yuga people, compared to Kali Yuga people who are very passive and fatalistic, now we're really interested in ourselves. Let's make things better right here, right now. I'm actually willing to do something about this now. And I don't even want to wait for heaven. I want heaven on earth. And what can make things better for me? And I'm willing to put out some energy to do it. We're more empowered, also more self-interested. Commerce is a very, very big thing in Dwapara Yuga, and it it arises because, I mean, commerce, think of the merchant consciousness of a Vaishya. To some extent, all these yugas line up with the caste system, so the Shudras are down in Kali Yuga, just sort of going, whatever. and, okay, if you hit me, I'll move, but I don't have a lot of other motivation. Dwapara is the Vaishya consciousness, the merchant. I'm willing to put out energy if there's something in it for me. And so I'm willing to do some work and trade this for equal value from you, and we start developing bigger cities, bigger systems, in industrialization to help us make more stuff that we can get and improve our lives however we think that's going to happen. So those are some big things. The individual becomes much more important, at least equal to, if not more more important than institutions. Government, yes.
That seems to be a good thing, right? Making the world a better place. So why is it, if we are doing good thing in Dwapara Yuga, why is it we are going into a bad Kali Yuga?
No, this is, we're going up right now.
Oh.
Yeah, this is getting better. It still has a long way to go, but we're on the upward cycle. So actually, this picture here, we looked at these guys together at the bottom first, but now we're specifically going up this side, and then we're going to come down the other way again.
She might have the wrong start date. She might.
What do you mean?
Yeah, I understood now. I thought we were
going
the other
way. So we're going the fun way first.
Can we just run out of time and stop you?
if nobody comes back after the break, then I guess we're done. In terms of government, we come out of hereditary monarchies who just tell all their peasants what to do, and we get more into democracies, which is still not perfect, but they say it's the worst form of government except for all the others. At least it is right now. It's at least the best one that we can handle, and we get it because each one of us is like, yes, I'm important. I need to have a say in this. Give me a vote. This just fits our consciousness perfectly. Whereas we had previously been really just focused entirely on our senses, now there's more of a shift towards reason and rationality and logic and that kind of mental processing. We can get a little bit more abstract, a little more sophisticated, because of this. And the formula that they give us in the book, and we can compare it to the previous one, is self-interest as opposed to passive acceptance. I'll just take it because I was born a peasant, so I'll stay a peasant. Mm-hmm. Self-interest. I don't want to be a peasant. Let me go be a merchant. Instead of being dull-mindedness, we're ready to think and reason and use a little more intellectual power. And instead of matter awareness only really being aware of stuff, we have energy awareness. And
I just want to share real quick that I really see this, like I've been directing, teaching in the classroom with young kids for like almost 4 decades, and I've worked with kids before the internet, and when the internet came, and when it became more accessible to children, and especially young children, what I see is the young children who were exposed to it too much, they become very myopic, they don't take social cues, they come basically like Asperger children, so they do have this self-interest, they do have this awakened intellect, but there's this disconnect from reality and what's going on around them. I'm talking extreme statements, but it really fits what you're saying.
Yeah, and there's problems with, you know, most ages until you're at the very, very top, certainly, and you know, there's stuff, just because stuff is going on in this yuga that's more advanced than the last yuga doesn't mean everything's great or has no drawbacks. So energy, part of it is us. It's our own personal empowerment, using our willpower to make changes in the world. It's also more obvious things about our technology. So, you know, Kali Yuga ended in 1700, and we've had the Industrial Revolution. We eventually got electricity. You know, things, we can just see how energy has changed. I mean, we made atom bombs, we made rockets that went to the moon, all these ways of using energy. We're still doing a lot with applying energy to matter, like splitting an atom so that we can blow stuff up is still a very matter physical oriented way of dealing with energy, but we're applying a lot more energy just to our experience of matter.
But also we still have all of our institutions and forms and ways of being and thinking are a lot of them are still leftovers from Kali Yuga.
Yeah.
So the way we build, the way we organize the planet, most governmental systems are still left over from the end of Kali Yuga, right? And so now we've got beginning awakening going on, but we still have all of these contexts and expectations which are leftovers, right? And so there's naturally an enormous conflict, you know. You've got people still thinking in terms of wars as being the final solution if nothing else works, right? And as you know, the Kali Yuga mindset is like, you know, you just go to war and figure duke it out, right? You know, but now we've got nuclear bombs and that mindset at the same time. And so
to some extent we have to apply energy to matter to break up some of these systems and structures in the world so that we can have a more fluid energetic experience that is holding us back from. So you know, this is still low on the wheel, and you know, just because we're in an age of energy doesn't necessarily mean it's at all conducive to wisdom or peace or harmony or anything. But we're changing, and we're hopefully changing in the right direction.
It's very helpful to me when we say, you know, Kali Yuga person and Dwapara Yuga person. It's helpful for me to think that the norm. The average consciousness of the population is there.
Yeah.
So Kali Yuga, the norm or average consciousness was with those characteristics.
Yeah.
In Dwapara Yuga, the norm, so that is almost represented by the leaders, right? So in Kali Yuga, the leaders have that consciousness. And although there's a range within the population of the two extremes, the norm or the people who lead the planet have that consciousness. In Dwapara Yuga, we're there physically maybe in that thing, but the leaders are actually not there yet.
The people who are able to make the most influence are those who are most in tune with that time. So maybe that's what you're trying to get at, whether they're political leaders or scientific leaders or whatever, just call them people who are uncomfortable at that time, right? So
because they'll have the most energy behind them from all the other people who are also
magnetized.
Yeah.
Maybe they help magnetize.
It's easier for them to operate in the way that is being reinforced by their environment.
And right now we're lopsided because the influential leaders normally are like Kali, but they're all these cells of Dwapara people groups.
And we're still close to the transition, so we still have a lot of pieces in there, and sometimes it seems like you have more of one or more of the other. We need to take heart in the fact that we are on the upward swing of our cycle here, so it's going to be changing the way we want it to go. It's just messy for
it's
a while.
It's going to be painful to get there.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you were saying the leaders haven't caught up to
the influential
people.
Yeah, and they're coming up, like Bill Gates and all these Dwapara leaders are becoming more influential in the world, but still the political leaders are not there yet.
Yeah, because they're different kinds of leaders.
They're in charge of the structures that we still have left over.
Mm-hmm.
But Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, you know, they're not politicians, but they've been hugely influential. In a very Dwapara way.
Right.
So
new domains and led within those domains rather than leading in the old structures.
Yeah, and I think that they're the type of leader that Dwapara is going to have. So these fiefdoms or empires are going to start falling apart. And the kind of influential leaders we're going to have are more like the Bill Gates and all these other kind of people.
Leaders of self-interest awakening, intellect, and energy awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be a religious person.
Or a spiritual person. Yeah.
I'd also add that there's a little more distinction here that I see with, like, one of the moms of my preschool, Susan Wojcicki, who's, like, according to Time magazine, is the most powerful woman on the Internet. So I think when we see more women, she's the CEO of YouTube, and Google came out of her garage, basically. So we have this energy of the mother coming in. Thank God, you know, it's like the Dalai Lama said, we need more women in leadership or we're doomed. So that's.
And also because we're more about individuals now and less about fixed physical reality, so your gender isn't so important as the fact that you're an individual and you can do whatever you want to do. And, you know, that applies to the men and the women, so that will get more balanced out, I expect. This is Ananda Village. I put it in there because intentional communities is something that will be a trend for Dwapara Yuga, because again, people are self-interested and they want to have a say in how they're living. It's like, I don't want to live with these random people in my apartment complex. Let me get my friends together and actually just put our energy into making something that we want. And we're doing it from a very spiritual perspective at Ananda, obviously, but it could happen in lots of different ways. And this is one of the things that the internet enables in a virtual way, because, you know, even if you're lonely and have no friends who are interested in the things you're interested in your area, you can get online and find, you know, a whole group of people from around the world and hang out with them online and have your community that way. The in religion, there's you get a trend that's moving away from man is here and God is here and never the twain shall meet, to each individual can and should have their own direct spiritual experiences. You don't go pay a priest to go have your spiritual experience for you and give you the good karma. Like, you meditate, you have your own experiences. You don't necessarily have to physically remove yourself from the world to have a spiritual life. In Kali Yuga, if you wanted to be a monk, you went and you locked yourself in a monastery and you were separated there. And there are still monasteries around, but to a much, much lesser degree, and a lot of the old style ones are just dissolving and disappearing. And the newer ones that even bother to call themselves monasteries are much more open and flexible. We still have monks and nuns at Ananda, but we're engaged with the world and we're not cut off from it. And also, we're really clear that you don't have to be a monk or a nun. You can have a full, fulfilling spiritual life, you know, with a job, a family, all the stuff that used to be just completely antithetical to that kind of a life.
It's interesting that the break between the Catholic dogma and the Protestant Reformation consisted of the idea that it was okay for individuals to actually read the scriptures.
Ah.
You know, before then it wasn't even legal to translate the Bible out of Latin. It was a radical departure which people gave their life for, to be able to translate it into the vernacular language.
And when was that?
Like 14, 15.
Oh, so that was even just a little ahead of...
And
of
Kali Yuga, yeah.
Yeah, so those were some real pioneers.
Yeah. they were right at the transition period, yeah. The transitioning out of Kali Yuga. It's like, hey, we don't actually have to hide the Bible in a foreign language anymore. We can actually let anyone read it. And the idea that a normal person would be able to read the Bible leads naturally to the idea that they might have their own opinion about what it says. That they might actually get an idea from it that doesn't match the dogma. It's just like terrifying to them, you know, to the old structures, right? But of course, that is the direction that everything is going, right?
Yeah.
Is that you can't.
Yeah,
and also, really didn't the church change it though, so that there wasn't a notion of reincarnation that could exist in the Bible anymore, so that more people could come to church because they only had one shot at it.
Well, you can when you hide people from the scriptures and they don't have their own ability to access that directly, it's much more easy to make up dogmas that suit the power structure.
Yeah.
And then tell people that that's the dogma. You know, better live with it or else they're killed.
Healing is something that is going to be happening more and more on an energetic level. And, you know, a lot of us have seen that going on already. An interesting example is acupuncture, which comes from the last Dwapara Yuga descending and was almost lost during Kali Yuga, and it's come back to a great extent now at this point. And people who are really into the subject could probably talk a lot more about it than I could, but we've probably all seen that there's lots of energy healing type of things. I mean, pick up the East-West catalog downstairs and see how many events are related to different kinds of energy healing. Yogananda talked about how we will be able to heal with rays, and it's not really entirely clear yet what he means. I mean, we have X-rays. It's not really healing. It's using rays of a sort for medicinal treatment. Color therapy, though, might be an example of that. Light rays in different colors, and that's something that people have used. I think Mahavir and Connie were telling us about some machine that does color therapy, actually injecting it into your bloodstream. So you have what looks like an IV thing, but instead of putting a fluid or something, it's actually beaming a color of light into your bloodstream. They'd have to talk more about it because I don't it's beyond me, but this is the direction we're going, as opposed to like, well, better give you a pill, better cut off the damaged limb, whatever, that's entirely physical. What
kill
can we
bacteria,
do on a
kill the virus.
Yeah,
kill,
what can we do on a more subtle
it,
level?
Yeah.
Well, and also our health issues may also be linked to the energy of the technology. So, you know, we're in a lot of waves right now, right? We're in
yeah.
a lot of Wi-Fi, we're in a lot of cellular.
Yeah, we're doing different
things
for our bodies.
Our bodies will be doing different things and maybe responding those.
Would be new techniques to deal with new problems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And energy is neutral. You know, energy, just having energy isn't necessarily positive. You know, we can use it for all sorts of different ways, and we may be using it to fix what we've already done with it.
You might initially misuse it before you figure out how to properly
yeah.
use it, too.
So yeah.
You brought up something that has always been important for me to try to think about, that Yogananda says, right? So he said, can you go to one where you can see the mirror image? You know, with Yogananda.
Like
Yogananda always said that Sri Yukteswar told him not to read other people's interpretations,
mm-hmm.
to try to go within, and he encouraged that, and Swami encouraged that in us.
Yeah.
And I feel like that one of the reasons that is possibly what they were trying to tell us is they're trying to help us make the quantum leap. They're trying to help us to leap into this consciousness and skip over Kali Yuga.
Yeah.
Because even though here we could read the scriptures and we could interpret the scriptures, we were still interpreting it with structured material mentality. And so if you read interpretations written during this time, you're influenced by stuff. And so our masters are saying, go within, because within is the knowledge that you have. You know, sort of like maybe not just here, but go there, you know. But
yeah.
but the within is the knowledge. If you don't do the inner work to try to find out what it means inside, then you're going to be influenced by all of this information. And I thought that because of what you were saying about people doing the scriptures and the Reformation, and which that was a really good thing. But I know a lot of Protestant people who can't get beyond what's written. You
yeah.
know, right?
Yeah.
And they are so intellectually attached to the ideas that they cannot go in to do more. And I feel that it was good not to have at some level, it was good not to have the writings during that time, because all people had was what was inside.
Well, when Tondiva gets to the descending part,
yeah.
I'm sure he'll talk about, you know, that the scriptures are an artifact of descent rather than a high
yeah.
thing. Right, you know, so that the need for them is an artifact of moving
yeah.
into a lower time.
Mm-hmm.
So
the
way
you shared that, though,
yeah.
I got a lot out of that. I keep standing up.
And just more in the way of trends, this is some of Dana Lynn Anderson's art, which I love. This wouldn't have flown 1,000 years ago as art. It's like, that's a mess. But I love
There's
it.
No structure.
So art, not just painting, but all forms of art are getting less structured, less formalized. But they're also becoming more, people realize that it's good for individuals to do it, even if it doesn't become good art, just because we have an experience. I mean, there's art therapy. And whatnot, and you should just learn to play a musical instrument just because it's fun, and it'll be good for you. You don't have have to be, you know, born into the musician's class and a professional and do this, you know, as the only person who can do it, but it's for all of us.
It's about energy and flow.
Yeah, and R.D. at the preschool level, it really encourages divergent thinking.
Yeah.
Just experimenting.
Yeah, being an individual, because we're individually focused now. So anyway, I like Dana's art. It's very Dwapara. And another big theme of Dwapara Yuga is space. And I put this one sort of ironically on here, the final frontier, because we call it the final frontier, or we just have this phrase, because at a certain level, it seems like the final frontier. We're still remembering Kali Yuga, okay, like this planet Earth is the main thing. Oh, but there are other planets out there. Okay, so we've expanded some, but we're still kind of thinking in terms of where we can go. And it's more than before, but it will not actually be the final frontier as we get into higher yugas. But for now, this is kind of what we're focused on. And I just love that our culture came up with this phrase, because that is a theme for these 2,400 years of Dwapara, is demolishing the delusion of space, or the limitations of space. And this is something that we can see already, again, with the internet. The internet has come up a lot, because it's the way we can do things. And it's energy, it's applied to matter. You know, we're using, you know, physical circuits and screens and keyboards or you know, devices and things to do this, but we can pick up a phone and talk to somebody in India right now with basically no time delay, and it's practically like they're there. So early Dwapara, that's maybe what it looks like to have to be, you know, just getting rid of the limitations of space, where before you would have to travel months to get to India, and you couldn't communicate on the way.
And in this cycle, we just happen to be in a situation where we can apply technology to that problem, right? So it's natural. One of the first things we would apply it to is communications.
Yeah. Yeah, because right now we're applying energy to matter, because that's where we are. We will gradually learn to work more and more with our life force energy, not electricity, but really the energy that animates us more directly. I mean, this is why we have the energization exercises from Yogananda, to try and get us tuning into that. And so we'll be able to do stuff more and more subtly. And who knows, maybe our, you know, we have Skype calls now, maybe we event teleporters, I don't know, maybe it's more subtle, just like remote viewing. I mean, there are people who can just, who are able to psychically see what's happening somewhere else. Maybe that will become a lot more common. I don't know. When I worked at Google, there was sort of this running joke. We had a company-wide email list that anybody could be on for just like throwing out crazy ideas and seeing if anything stuck, you know? And the running joke was that almost any discussion on that list eventually came around to the fact that, okay, but first we need to build a teleporter. And somehow everything just got us back there, because this is just one of the themes of our age, is space is an issue, not having everything in the same place. How are we dealing with that to make it not an issue?
How about off-world civilizations?
How about them?
They're going to be involved in the final frontier, I would imagine. I mean, people aren't really even thinking about that so much, but now with all the alien talk, and if you really think about it, it's obvious there's other civilizations somewhere.
So who knows? I mean, somehow that limitation of being so far away will have to change. And whether that's simply being able to be aware of what's happening there, actually going there, it's hard to tell. But, you know, there were UFO sightings in Yogananda's day. Not maybe as many as now, but there were some. And he said, you know, at least some of those are real. Obviously, some people are just making stuff up. But he said, oh, yeah, there are other planets. There are beings on other planets. They, you know, they visit sometimes. Things happen.
So he said, you know, each galaxy has something like trillions of planets. And, you know, they're all, and many of them are potentially inhabited. And are inhabited.
And actually, some of us might have alien blood.
Sure.
We don't know.
Yeah,
I
this
mean,
is
off-world.
How do you define alien?
Off-world.
Yeah, and that gets tricky because, I mean, can they even interbreed? Who knows? He didn't go into details on that. But life doesn't even necessarily look like what we think. I mean, we're looking for planets that can support life, and so we look for for water, we look for certain climates and whatever, but Yogananda said that they're beings made of gases that live on the surface of the sun. So, if aliens visit, are we even going to see them, depending on what they are? Who knows? Like, we can't get into this because they just have no clue. But
I just wanted to share real quick, it's not uncommon in my school, for my school is like 80% Israeli, so it's not uncommon for us to have a birthday celebration and then have the grandparents who are on the other side of the planet, basically, who are, you know, a half a day difference, be at the birthday party on Skype.
That's the internet for you. Yep. So that's where we are with this project in early Dwapara. Let's see what it is. So according to Sri Yukteswar, before Dwapara Yuga is over, so over the next 2,000 years, mankind will learn two overarching lessons. One, the experience of happiness, the feeling of being happy, is a result of movement of our life force in our bodies. And we talk about this when we teach meditation and the energy moving up and down the spine. And we want it to go up and we have the magnet here at the spiritual eye, so that's how we meditate. Two, the experience of personal happiness is enhanced through the expansion of one's awareness and sympathies. So this, you know, we're mostly being very self-centered, individualistic, but by the end, so we're coming up to the transition now, we're going to start expanding beyond that. And again, this is something that we talk about in our teachings. Our teachings, to some extent, touch on all the yugas because we're ultimately trying to get ourselves to the top no matter what yuga we're living in. So we're going to see things we recognize even if the overall planet isn't quite there yet. But in 2,000 years, a lot of people are going to agree on these things and it'll be a very nice change from now. And by the close of Dwapara, which you can see is only like about a third up the side of the circle, Dharma is one half developed. So again, we're nicely weighted towards the top because we've covered half of the two yugas. They're just shorter than the high ones. And so we'll be working with our intellect, but as our intellect gets more energetic, more into an energetic flow, it's going to start moving towards intuition. And so reason and logic, that's what happens as they start to get less attached to the physical form that we're leaving behind and move up into even yet another age. Okay, so Treta Yuga.
Just one more quick thing. So it's about space, but also it seems like it's about time, because that example I gave, so if we're doing a circle time at 10, and in Israel it's 8 o'clock at night, there's all of a sudden time takes on a different reality.
Though you still have to deal with the fact that you may have gotten the grandparents out of bed.
That's
right. So, we haven't sorted that out yet, but it's coming up. Because here we are in Treta Yuga. And at this point, we used to be really focused on matter. That was all there is. We work with energy and we learn to use energy to control matter. In this age, we're going to learn about how thought can control energy, which controls matter. So we're taking it up even another level. The individualized self-interest becomes the desire for personal perfection, for self-mastery. Again, we recognize this as yogis. We're developing self-control, and we understand how this is a way that's going to help us grow closer to divine bliss. Whereas a Kali Yuga person is like, why do I want to control myself? Just let me enjoy the things of the senses. I don't want to work on myself. Reason and intellect will turn into something more intuitive, more intuitive attunement. And the formula, again, comparing with the other ones, self-mastery, intuitive attunement, and thought awareness. And again, you can sort of look vertically and just see how things are developing here. Now,
would that correspond to astral consciousness or casual consciousness?
Causal. Causal. Yeah. Yeah, sort of physical, astral, causal, God, I guess would be the four equivalents.
So are we in astral?
Causal.
Indra-hara.
We're in Treta Yuga now. So Treta would be causal, the thought.
Okay.
And astral is energy. So even now, even in every age, our thoughts control a lot more than most of us are aware of. I think the most fascinating example of this is people with multiple personalities. Because if somebody has several personalities and they switch between them, whatever the technical term for this condition is, it's not only their personalities that change. There are documented cases of a single person who has one personality that is allergic to something and one personality that is not. One personality has a mole and the other one does not. One personality has different eye color and the other one does not. One personality takes a sleeping pill and then they switch into the other personality and they're just totally wide awake, as if they hadn't had the sleeping pill at all. And however this is working, and it's not under their control at this point, but you know, whatever is happening in there is changing at such a fundamental level of awareness that these physical levels of reality are just actually responding to it and changing. And in Treta Yuga, we'll be getting to the point where we can actually understand that and start to work with it deliberately.
I was just going to add to that. In India, there was a movie taken about the same personality thing. This guy is very orthodox, and he doesn't like all the bad things that's going on around him, but he's afraid to confront it. So he changes into the extreme personality where he is the superhero and tries to punish all the people that did bad things to others. In the way written in the scriptures, like if you kill a person, you're going to die in a certain way, not like a normal death. Mm-hmm. So he is kind of turning into this personality where he, whatever the other person is afraid of doing, he is doing it in a more bold, bad way.
That's interesting. So Dwapara was the hero in that, in one of the examples you gave. You said God, demigod, hero, and human.
Right. For the metaphors for the ages.
Mm-hmm. I guess if you have control in the sort of astral energy control.
Or you're willing, the hero, the ordinary men are just sitting there just suffering. But the hero is somebody who's willing to put out energy to change it.
Yeah.
So
our image of a hero is a vigilante.
Individual, and high energy.
Whereas the higher yugas, the heroes, in Satya Yuga, the heroes will be the masters.
I heard that Yogananda would become, he would change, and would be like the person in the room.
Oh, there's Swami has commented on how you can look at a lot of photos of masters standing with somebody, and there's a way that he looks kind of like them in each of those photos, even if they're very different. And it's fun, like flip through a book, like there are several in Conversations with Yogananda that I've noticed. Look at the picture of Yogananda next to his brother Ananta, and he looks very different than when he's standing next to Amalita Galikurchi or standing next to whoever else. Oh, in the AY, he's standing next to his sister, and they just look so similar. So it's fun. Start looking at those pictures of Yogananda plus somebody else and just sort of see how he's reflecting them back to them.
A fluid way to interface with someone, right?
Yeah. So in Treta Yuga, people will start being able to actually communicate more with thought. And there are people who can do that to some extent now. Judging by those people, it's unlikely that it would really be a lot like verbal communication with words and sentences like this. It would probably be a lot more images and impressions and feelings. So there could be a lot of communication. It might not seem as precise to us because we're used to like finding the right words for the right things, but it could really be much richer as well, because you now don't have to take every word that I'm saying and interpret it and decide how you want to relate to it. You just get the impression and get the feeling. And something that's fun to imagine here is imagine now musicians, artists, people like this who don't just play a note on the piano and you have to hear it and interpret it. They are also conveying their feelings about the music or about the art. And this happens to some extent already. Swami Kriyananda has one of my favorite books, Art is a Hidden Message. The hidden message in art is the consciousness that created it, that performed it, that receives it. It's because it is all about consciousness. But we'll be much more aware of it in Treta Yuga. And performers can really use it. And like Swami Kriyananda tells us, you know, when you're singing a song, feel the consciousness of it. Really try to communicate it. Don't just do the words and the notes. But this will be a regular thing in Kali Yuga. And think of the experience you can have listening to a great piece of music and really feeling what Beethoven felt when he wrote that symphony, you know.
I'm an impatient person, and Yukteswar was able to get to Kali, get to Dwapara Yuga. Why do we have to wait 2,000 years?
What do you mean, get? He was able to get to?
He was able to experience the intuitive attunement, yes, and the astral, causal intellect.
Yeah. He was an avatar.
We're talking about waiting until 4,000 AD?
No, we're not, because remember what I said, you don't just keep following the planet. You go where your consciousness is in tune with it. So if your consciousness is in tune with Satya Yuga and Earth is in Kali Yuga, you just don't show up here. You go to that planet where it's already Satya Yuga. So everything that we're doing here at Ananda is to raise our consciousness. And you can have that consciousness. Like you said, Sri Yukteswar had complete God realization. Jesus did at the very bottom of the cycle. So we need to get ourselves there no matter what yuga we're living in.
And he did go to a different planet.
Yes. You're talking about, he's on Hiranyaloka, which is a causal planet, and he's helping people.
The fundamental teaching is that you will incarnate at the time and the place that's appropriate for your spiritual growth. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't always mean that you're going to be exactly in tune with the yuga that you're in. Your purpose to be there might be to help uplift people who are at a lower consciousness. You won't be very much aligned with what's going on there. Just kind of like, we're not very in tune with where we are right now. We're people that would be more comfortable at the top of Dwapara, trying to function at the bottom of Dwapara, but we're here partially for a project,
which is to push society towards the top of Dwapara.
Yeah, we're helping uplift it, right? So that's why we're here right now. But we're not incarnating in Treta because we're probably just personally not ready for that.
We probably wouldn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And our personalities are probably trapped.
If you just took us knowing what we know and what we're in tune with and put us at the bottom of Kali Yuga, we would be the heads of monasteries. You know, we would be, you know, that kind of thing. We'd be people who would be more in tune with that. But you will incarnate at the time and place that's appropriate for your dharma, your karma, your personal spiritual needs, as well as your any mission you may have. And so that may be on this planet. If there's a place for you, you'll go to it. If there isn't, you won't.
And you can achieve God realization at any age.
That's the point I was getting to, I guess.
Yeah, so do your best right where you are. Like, Yogananda gave us all the tools we need to do that. So, you know, if you want to do that, and you should, then then go like gangbusters into everything he gave us.
There's also another little bit of, I think, an unstated assumption behind your question, which is this concept of we and humanity, right? That humanity itself has a trajectory is really a false belief, right? That humanity must grow, that there's a cosmic purpose for humanity as a whole, as we conceive it on this planet, meaning the population of humans on the Earth. It's not important what happens, generally speaking, to the trajectory of the population of humans on the planet. If it were, then it would really suck, because everything eventually gets destroyed every 24,000 years or more often, right? You know, so that's not what's important. It's the individual soul that comes back and forth to this particular plane to learn some lessons, and eventually everything dissolves, but except the lessons that were learned stay with you, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really matter that the planet happens to be in Dwapara Yuga right now. It's still a great place for 7 billion people to be learning a lot of lessons at this time. And sometimes it's fewer people, and sometimes it's more people, but they're all learning.
The Bible instructs us, I'm Christian background, instructs us to preach the gospel to the world.
Because we're helping to uplift and
enrich.
People who are bothering to read the Bible have the great karma to be wanting to know higher truths, right? And this is a time when higher truths should be shared.
Yep.
So.
And right then you're ahead of.
I'm not sure, this is good time to be human because we are advancing. But what about the animals and birds that are being killed a lot more now than they do?
What is
their stage of?
Yeah, I mean, their stage is pre-human, and karma is a lot more automatic, Master said, when you're an animal,
mm-hmm.
Because there's less ego, there's less self-direction as an animal. And, when your consciousness can only handle being a worm and thinking about dirt, then that's what you get to be. And, as your consciousness can handle more, you get to be different kinds of animals. And, and some animals, yes, we kill them, and they go and they incarnate as another animal, whatever they're ready to be for. We also have a lot of pets, and pets living closely with humans are usually just about ready to become a human themselves in their next lifetime, which is why we don't need to be too sad when our cat dies, because, hey, he gets to be a human now, probably. And so that's really good for him. For our own consciousness, we should not be cruel to animals. And Yogananda said that highly evolved animals like cows and pigs are terrified when they're slaughtered, and that vibration is in the meat and it affects us, so that's another reason. And perhaps to some extent the energy of the yugas helps them, but they're still in a consciousness that can only handle being a frog or whatever it is, because that's where they are. And the frog, it's not going to be a huge difference whether it's Kali Yuga or Satya Yuga, he's going to be a frog.
I'm a bit of an abstract thinker, so sometimes my comments don't make sense, but I love the Treta Yuga self-mastery thing, right? So in Dvapara, it's energy, and maybe how energy, using energy to control emotions. So now whatever gets integrated by your senses may give an emotion, but your energy will control the emotion or change it,
yep.
In a good way. And then in Treta Yuga, it's not just energy that you're controlling. It's sort of like, by your comments, I'm thinking it's about mastery of not responding anymore. Like you've mastered your mirror is now spotless, and so your intuition. Though we have intuition before that. We don't have mastery of our mirror is not spotless. So what I believe to be intuitive, because here at Ananda, people are very intuitive.
Yeah.
So you come in with a certain energy, and people are going to pick it up because you pick it up from other people. But the thought for me is always how much of this thing that I'm experiencing is my spotted mirror. How pure is my intuition about this energy or feeling that I'm feeling? And I'm thinking there's still a lot of spots in the mirror, but in Treta Yuga, because your mirror is spotless, or because you have mastery at that level, your communication, your intuition, what the thoughts that you are picking up from the other person are true. They're the expression of what the other person had, and there's less of your spotted mirror to tell you, so then it becomes a true communication.
Yeah, well, now, Treta Yuga, of course, is a progression just like everything else, so what you're saying is maybe more at the top of Treta Yuga,
mm-hmm.
and we'll be working towards that, but we'll have an understanding of how we work with our thoughts, just like now we're developing an understanding of how we work with our energy, and we can do it to some extent. And we're playing with our thoughts now, too. We have affirmations.
Right.
I mean, imagine Treta Yuga, you take an affirmation, and you just take it and you put it into your thought energy and you have it, as opposed to I have to recite this 20 times a day and maybe gradually it'll sink in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've really mastered yourself. You can just say, oh, I will incorporate that. I'll install the software update and you have it. So this will be developing throughout the yuga. Related to what I was saying earlier about the artists and everybody. Oh, another example in the book was cooks. Imagine that you could just perceive exactly the perfect tastes and textures that somebody most wants and needs in their dish, and you make something customized for them. But they also say beauty will now really not be skin deep, because you'll have a much better perception of somebody's actual character and thoughts. And a beautiful face with ugly thoughts behind it, you know, everybody's going to be aware of that much more. And we get that now to some extent, but it'll be much clearer. It'll just be like their face probably to us. And along those lines, government is also going to change, because, I mean, imagine if you could see what the character was of your politician or whoever, and not really be trying to guess, are they lying, like what really happened here, do they have something sinister in mind, etc. But government will also change, and so democracy is the thing for us now that we're okay with. Enlightened leaders is sort of the way they put it for Treta Yuga. And Swami Kriyananda mentioned this too, and it's a little bit the way Ananda was created. Like, everybody just automatically looked up to Swami. We didn't put him up for a vote every year, because we knew him, we knew his character, we knew, you know, what he was doing. We know we all want to be a part of this, and we trust him. And there's still individual autonomy, and everybody has to work together and cooperate together. But it's just clearer who you have leading. You don't have to have everybody guessing and then voting and then comparing the guesses, which is basically what democracy is, how many people guessed one way or another who's going to do the best job. You can say, I want, you know, we want a person with this character leading us. And, you know, it's not clear exactly how they will get chosen, but it'll look different than just straight-up democracy like we have now. Master said, war does continue up through Treta Yuga. So even that high up, you know, people are not perfected. I mean, if we're on this planet, we're not perfected, pretty much, aside from the avatars. So there's still going to be conflicts and things will happen.
So is that the Kshatriya age?
Kshatriya?
Yeah. Say that again?
Kshatriya?
Kshatriya, the warrior age?
That's not why it would be called the Kshatriya.
Right, because we have a lot more war down here.
but
they do say it would probably be more... The wars would probably be more honorable. There wouldn't be any bombing of civilians or anything. It would might be more even individual, just like warrior against warrior, using maybe even thought energy to some degree.
He said that wars will be conducted with mantras.
Yeah. Yeah, so it will look different, but it will still happen.
Interesting, wars are conducted with mantras and other psychic energies.
World thoughts.
And of course, thoughts affect energy, and energy affects matter. So who knows what the ultimate appearance of that war will be? I mean, we're very much getting into guesswork here.
Probably be different at the bottom of Treta from the top of Treta, too.
Because
the last war ever fought would probably be a war of ideas.
Just at the very top.
And whereas, you know, at the bottom, the wars are going to be probably have more visible manifestation to them, but still directed by thought.
Now, whereas Kali Yuga, we were learning to deal with matter. Dwapar Yuga, the theme was overcoming the limitations of space. Treta Yuga, you were jumping ahead just a few minutes ago, is about overcoming the delusion of time. And again, it's not necessarily clear, are you going to be able to step into a time machine and go somewhere else, in which case you might think, why haven't we've seen somebody just showing up. but it might all be mental, because this is all about thought power and everything, but to some extent that will happen. This is Bhrigu, an ancient sage from Treta Yuga, and on the right are some writings from the Book of Bhrigu, which is not really a book, but it's scattered parchments and scrolls and palm leaves and carved bits of wood, you know, scattered throughout India, these special places that have collected these writings that were made thousands of years ago and copied and to preserve them over the years. And they are prophecies about people today. So Swami Kriyananda went, and there are different ways they work depending on where you go, but I think he went to one where they either cast his horoscope or the horoscope of the moment that he was there asking for it. And then based on that horoscope, everything is filed. So I don't know if it says, okay, so Saturn is here. Where's the box with the Saturn in this sign or whatever? But they find it based on that match. And if there's and there was something for him, and it gave his birth name, it gave his monastic name, it gave facts about his family, including something he didn't know about his mother that he later verified. It talked about, you know, finding his guru, and it just told him all these things about his life now, that but it was written thousands of years ago. And there are many, many of these that have been passed down through the ages. And there will be things like, oh, I think it was Swami who went again later to a different place, got another one, and it said, I've already given him a reading, but I'll add a few things here. There was somebody else who, you know, the person was reading their prophecy that they found, and it said, at this moment in the reading, there will be a thunderclap, and there was. I think I've heard it said that not all of these were necessarily written by Bhrigu, but maybe by a bunch of his students. But in Treta Yuga, you could have this kind of thought power that you could just go elsewhere in time and look and go, oh, look, this guy is going to show up at this time. Let's do a prophecy for him. Write it down so they can save it.
Yeah, they said he used that as his way to train his disciples.
Yeah.
Just to have them just sit and write out all of these.
Yeah, so all the students would practice and then say, as long as you did it, let's just save it.
Yeah.
And these guys will find it later on.
Yeah. Then they create a way to find it when the time comes.
Yeah, with the horoscopes or whatever else it was.
Too far out.
Yeah, and because we aren't there yet. But these things will be as normal to us as, you know, early Dwapara, somebody trains as an electrician. You know, that would have been crazy to somebody in 500 AD. Like, what are you doing with this you know, witchcraft? But it's now it's just like, electricity, whatever. And the Dwapara will be using our life force as casually as we use electricity. And Treta Yuga, they'll be using their thoughts.
To overcome time.
Yep.
And
to overcome a lot of things.
Connect to the thoughts of other people in other times.
Yeah. It will effectively be the way they interact with the world a lot, you know, to make things happen. You know, we use electricity either to manipulate matter or to accomplish what we used to accomplish with matter. And we'll just start shifting a lot of that to our thought.
Ananda talks about tuning into the consciousness of saints from other times. So he tuned into Veda Vyasa,
yeah.
You know, who wrote the Gita and the Mahabharata.
And there's the idea that, you know, if you imagine time or creation or everything just as a circle, and we're typically just out on the edge of the circle traveling around, but masters put their consciousness in the middle, from which point you can just peek out at any edge of the circle you want. Right there.
Because one thing mentioned there earlier was telepathy.
Telepathy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what we would call, you know, communicating with your mind. Yeah.
Also overcoming the time so that you can communicate with and break down the space and time.
So who needs the internet if you have the ability to communicate with thought with anyone in your current time as well as in other times?
Yeah, we won't have email anymore. We'll have T-mail.
Right, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
You'll mentally pay for things on Amazon.
So the book says, those living in Treta Yuga will eventually learn that their greatest happiness not lies simply in self-mastery as an end in itself, which has been the theme going up through Treta Yuga, but in using their self-mastery to attune themselves to expansive flows of thought. So you have to develop all this stuff, but then what do you do with it? That's what you start figuring out at the end when you've developed it a lot. The arc of Treta Yuga development, therefore, will be one of people learning to attune to thoughts that will lead to greater happiness. And again, this is what we do even now, trying to attune to our gurus. Mankind will learn that fundamentally, joy, security, and love are experienced by intuitive attunement to expansive and uplifting flows of thought. Now, thinking about this attunement, he puts in, it's sort of this little thought experiment that I just love, and he's taking music as an example. You could take a lot of different things that people might do. It says, music's highest octave could be described as the source of all harmonious vibration, the essence of music, if you will. And in Treta Yuga, because we're learning to attune ourselves to consciousness, this essence will be experienced as both divine and conscious. Attuning oneself to the essence of music, therefore, would be attuning oneself to a divine consciousness. a consciousness, moreover, that could respond, communicate, and interact. Sort of like, you know, if you want musical inspiration, God will speak to you through music and give you musical inspiration, but it's coming from God. There's this awareness of really attuning to that divine consciousness through music. We might think of such a conscious essence as a god or goddess. So I put Saraswati in here, goddess of music. We have these traditions of all these gods and goddesses, not just from the Indian tradition, but from all over. You know, imagine somebody in Treta Yuga who is a musician, and the way you are a musician in Treta Yuga is attuning to divine musical consciousness. But the divine is itself conscious. You can interact with it. You can communicate with it. And so you can personify it, whether it's your conception in your mind or it's a literal vision or whatever, and it gets turned into symbolically this goddess that we've named Saraswati. We have draw the pictures. We always give her her swan and her instrument and everything. And that gets passed down even when we can no longer have that experience ourselves. But it came from an experience that somebody had talking with God about music. When God talks to you about music, this is what God looks like.
This is the idea behind chants, right? Chanting. So that the idea to get that vibration, that God conscious vibration.
Well, maybe, and we don't usually present it that way, because we present it as a way of just changing our own consciousness, because we're sitting here at Dwapara Yuga, and not up here at Treta.
To that extent, where
and maybe it will happen, but it's more. I mean, Yogananda said he chanted every one of these until he got a response from the divine. So at some level, we will have a divine experience from these chants.
Just for your information, that's the thing that has attracted me most to Ananda is the music.
Yeah.
And the effect it had on me after being here a few times.
Yeah, and music is such a wonderful expression of energy. I mean, it's what gets a lot of people.
We have a conscious awareness here of music serving that purpose and working that way, and we deliberately work that way with it, and it affects people quite naturally.
As do the Hindus, so, yeah. Which I didn't realize until Ananda kind of bridged that over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're just, I mean, I think other people tune into that naturally, but we are consciously aware of it as a factor. So.
Absolutely.
It's about 11:35. Should we have a break before Satya Yuga?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
How long
is 5 minutes enough, or do we need more?
Two.
A little more.
Okay.
Years or two.
There's a bathroom there, obviously downstairs. There's tea and everything downstairs. The books are for sale downstairs.
Yeah, buy the book.
Come back?
Yeah.
What time should we come back?
Huh? 10 minutes would be 11:47, I guess.
Okay. This is really good.
Okay, so Satya Yuga, the good stuff. So this is the golden age. This is paradise. Sri Yukteswar says, in Satya Yuga, the human intellect can comprehend all, even God the Spirit beyond this visible world. And you know, they never actually wrote us out a little formula like the other ones had for Satya Yuga. Maybe just because the formula would just say God. Maybe that's enough. But they say the achievement of inner stillness and the refinement of direct intuitive perception will be the focus of development for Satya Yuga. And again, there will be a mix of people on the planet in this age. Not everyone will fully attain self-realization, but most people will strive for it. And Swami Kriyananda said it'll be a lot more like the whole world is kind of like Ananda, which will be a very nice place to be. The longer lifetimes will help this. Remember, we mentioned the lifetimes will go roughly up like 100, 200, 300, 400 years. So you can imagine, like, part of the difficulty of the spiritual life is you have to spend a while at the beginning of your life just kicking around, making mistakes, figuring out, you know, what you're actually supposed to be doing here. If you have 400 years, you know, you can spend the first 50 of them goofing off and still have a lot of time to sit down and get serious and meditate. And so that will help a lot. Though we'll probably be less inclined to goof off, hopefully, even for the beginning. But But we have more time to work with, and that will help before we reincarnate and have to remember all over again. All the traditions I mentioned before have having the different ages. You know, they all talk about having one up at that's basically paradise. We mentioned earlier that most of our history, we look back at those cultures, and they're all looking even farther back at something they descended from. And the idea of a paradise is one of the most common similarities in myths around the world. And one description of the Greek Golden Age describes it as an age not of wealth and luxury, but a sufficiency of natural food in conjunction with high moral character and a complete absence of wars and dissension. Ease and happiness are linked to simplicity and innocence of mind. So it's living lightly on the earth, it's living in tune with everything. In a book I didn't bring up to show is The Time Tunnel. It's Swami Kriyananda wrote it as a story for and about children, but they discover a time tunnel and they can just go visit other yugas, and he can just say stuff and not have to prove it all because it's just a story. But they visit Satya Yuga, and one of the things he mentions is the homes are very open to the element. They don't have screens on the windows or anything because they're in tune with nature, and everything is working in harmony, and the flies know not to fly inside because that's not their space. And you can just be that way because everything is so harmonious and in sync.
Is that in the bookstore?
It might be. I don't know. And if not, you can get it online. It might be at East West.
Good nap time reading for the kids.
The Time Tunnel. Yeah. Swami Kriyananda said that a woman in India told him about her guru, who lived very simply in the forest. Once, when a number of his disciples were with him, there was a heavy downpour of rain, but it was completely dry around them. It was as if he had created an astral umbrella, though he didn't say anything about it. When you have that inner power, it's a very small thing to ward off the rain. You can put out the kind of energy to prevent rain or to cause rain or even change the seasons. So we think of people living, 12,000 years ago as being cavemen, because we haven't found any structures that they built yet, and so they must have lived in caves. But they might not really have needed very much, because if you're just completely in tune with nature, and nature is in tune with you, and you can just keep the rain off like that sadhu in the forest if you need to, if the temperature, you can probably just affect the environment around you and just make it comfortable without having to build walls and air conditioning and whatever else we think we all need.
Mentally manifest a shelter and demanifest it when you're done with it.
Yeah, that too could be a possibility. I forget when the last ice age is, but I think it might have been around that time, and people would have been more compressed in towards the equator at that time with more ice coming in from the poles. And it might have just made a very very pleasant strip of habitable land right around the middle of the earth. Certainly the population was a lot less then. In this coming up out of Kali Yuga, physical, material, like have a lot of kids to work on your farm kind of mentality, up through Dwapara, developing huge cities and commerce and just wanting to expand in this kind of way, we've gotten a lot of people on the planet. But already, a lot of population growth is slowing down or even in some places declining. And that will probably actually be a trend continuing. Because, for one thing, we're not as attached to form. We don't have to give birth to somebody for them to be our family. We can find our spiritual family at a place like Ananda, however it works, however we think about it, but we don't just have to keep filling the world with people. We can just decide what's best for us, while we're in our individualized self-interest thing. Do I want to have kids? I don't have to, just because my parents did. But things are changing, and it will probably be a relatively small population on Satya Yuga, and probably relatively few souls who are ready to live here on Satya Yuga because they're just not that advanced.
And what you said also, I think, is a factor too, that the planet we go on happens to go through occasional catastrophes and ice ages, and they may not align perfectly with the yugas, right? So, you know, it may be a very high age, but very few people can live in it, or it could be that it aligns differently in a different time around the cycle. Mm-hmm. So we just happen to be at a time right now where there's been a combination of enormous population, ability to understand technology, interest in using technology and energy together, and it's created what we see around, and we define this as civilization. But if you really think about it from the perspective of Satya Yuga, this is not civilization. This is
going
like
nuts.
Really, really bad, right? You know?
So they'll be much more civilized.
They'll be much more civilized.
Even when they have a lot less stuff.
Yeah, when we're not raping the planet at the maximum possible rate, you know.
Everybody has exactly what they need in it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, just look at it like, what does it take to create an iPhone, right? You know, it takes a planet with billions of people on it.
Yeah,
to
that's actually about
that supply chain and that demand.
Yeah. So, yes.
Do the. Does he mention anything about. I've heard in Tibet there are these advanced monks that protect and guard certain entrances to the inner earth. Is there any information?
I know nothing about that, and it's not in the book.
From the information that they've given, it is this perfect 70 degree temperature.
I know nothing.
Okay.
So.
Thank
you. So in Satya Yuga, even then, it's not a free ride. The challenge in Satya Yuga is to avoid becoming too complacent and not waste the opportunity of getting to live on a planet with such high spiritual energy. Mm. And it's easy for us to go, oh, poor you, you're already in Satya Yuga, go cry me a river. But this is something actually to keep in mind too, for us. We should never get complacent. I mean, we can get here, we can find our guru, we can find Ananda, we can learn to meditate, and we can go, this is great, I'm just going to kick back and relax because I'm on the spiritual path. Everything's cool. you don't get to be complacent until you are God realized it's not over. But it'll be much more tempting there. Just like, you know, in between physical lives, when we're on the astral world, it can be tempting to just sort of hang out and enjoy the astral world and not really put effort into spiritual progress. Anyway, that'll be the main challenge for Satya Yuga, but we should remember it for ourselves because we can fall into it too. Things are nice on this spiritual path, and it gives us tools to just be happier throughout our lives. We can just sort of go, hey, this is a lot better than I used to be. Let's just sit on our laurels here for a while. And maybe you need a break sometimes, but, you know, don't get stuck there. So, we're up at the top point there. And this is a good time to remember that this is cyclical, and we can be looking forward and back. We've been talking about looking forward on the upswing because that's a nice optimistic way to do it. And at the end of all that, it will just start going down again. But as we go down this side, we're going to just start talking about it in terms of looking back, partly because it's nice to go, hey, thank goodness we're not there anymore. We don't have to think about this in our future. And partly because we actually have really interesting historical and archaeological evidence from some of these time periods, at least from the most recent cycle. And it'll be fun to look at those. Some things to keep in mind, just in terms of how much evidence there is or isn't, we already mentioned there were probably many, many fewer people at the time to leave evidence behind. And anything that, and, you know, archaeologists find bones, they find structures, they find whatever it is, and they make up theories and about what this is, and often it's based on really very little. This is I found this in an unrelated way, but I found it was fascinating. There was a new dinosaur species discovered, and these bones are what they found. Now, if I found that, I'd be hard-pressed to tell it wasn't a rock, you know. And here's what they're extrapolating it out to. Here's what they found of the whole dinosaur. you know. And apparently they've had enough experience to figure that this is a pretty good guess of what the dinosaur was. But, you know, we work with very, very little information. And so there's a huge margin of error for anything people think was going on in the past. And a lot of the times we have theories that are based on the assumption that we used to be primitive and we've gotten here in a straight line and that's it. And nobody could have been as advanced or more advanced than us. But if you are willing to change those assumptions, which this book does, you can make even better interpretations of things. Another point is just how fast things decay. And I found this image of, you know, if New York City or something was completely abandoned one day, how fast would things take over? And there, a guy, I can't remember his name, actually wrote a book called The World Without Us, which is, if humans just disappeared, how fast would things just go back to a state of nature? And, you know, in 1,000 years, New York City would just, you know, be rolling hills and trees and things. And, you know, we think of these skyscrapers as big, huge, permanent things. Why haven't we found skyscrapers from the past if all these civilizations were so advanced? Well, things take over pretty quick. Yeah, we're going to get to them. Oh, this is just an artist's rendition, so I don't know.
Three reasons. A, prior great civilizations may not have needed them. And may not have
right,
them.
Which is something we're going to talk about, yeah.
B, they might have cleaned up after themselves.
Yeah, if they're higher.
And
thank
C,
goodness.
All it takes is time and degradation and a few catastrophes to completely erase whatever's on the planet.
Yeah,
you know,
and they will have constructed different things. Yeah, we're going to talk about the pyramids. That's actually not even till Dwapara Yuga, but we'll get there. You were talking about construction. If you think about even to have a pencil, how many people are involved in that pencil? The people who chopped the trees for the lumber, who ran the lumber company, who sold it to the pencil creating company. Same deal with the lead. Same deal with the rubber that make the eraser. Same deal with a little bit of metal binding around that holds the eraser on. How many thousands of people does it take to get you a dumb pencil? And if you have 25 million people on the whole planet, as opposed to 7 billion, you just can't do things like this. Now, in Satya Yuga, you're basically like living in a paradise and a miracle, and you don't need to do all of that. And in Treta Yuga, you have, you know, your mind control to achieve a lot of these things. But, you know, that's just another reason why you will not necessarily have stuff left behind. One theme that we're going to see as we descend through the yugas is that, you know, compared to now, where we keep discovering new stuff, going down, we're forgetting stuff, and we're losing things. And we remember that it used to be better, we used to be able to do more, but we can't anymore. And
it's like getting old.
and it's finding out how to use the capabilities we still have to achieve what we used to have. And yeah, it's more depressing. So thank goodness we're here, right? So descending Satya Yuga, this is just the same slide, but just keep us clear where we are. Something that was around in the last Satya Yuga is Cro-Magnon man, who, you know, there's changing thoughts on Neanderthals, Cro-Magnons, how closely they were related to humans, were they really more primitive, etc. One of the interesting things about Cro-Magnon man is that his brain capacity was actually relatively larger. The big one is Cro-Magnon, and the small one is a modern human. Obviously, brain size doesn't mean everything, because blue whales have huge brains. But, you know, for a comparable human in body, that's just interesting that they lived in Satya Yuga and had an even bigger brain capacity. So, can't prove anything from that, but it's interesting.
Or they were bigger, right? I think they say they were actually bigger.
Maybe a little bit, but probably not proportionally to that. There's some evidence that early humans were vegetarian, or ancient humans were vegetarian. I don't know what that evidence looks like, but I take his word on that. And something that's interesting when you're trying to look this far back in history is mythology. Because, first of all, there's probably not spoken language at this time, right? Because we already learned mind communication in Treta Yuga, much less Satya Yuga, when everybody's just in tune with each other. But they're very good at just communicating directly and communicating divine experiences directly. And most of the ancient myths are about paradise, which is what they were living in, and in all the gods, which we had that example earlier about Saraswati, and just actually relating to God through music and basically having a god of music that way. And mythology is another very interesting thing that people who study it say it is very, very similar the entire world over, which is surprising if you think that people are just making it up, you know, as primitive tribes scattered around, not communicating with each other. Joseph Campbell, do I have him here? Yeah, he said that the myths of the world resemble each other as dialects of a single language. They're that similar. And so it's sort of everybody, even if there were few people scattered around the whole world, they could still be in communication with each other, because, you know, we already demolished time and space and verbal communication. We can just always be in communion with each other all the time. But as they gradually, and this would be through Treta Yuga probably also, lost that direct communication ability, they had to start developing language. And what kind of things did they want to share? Their divine experiences. Which is there, and there's your mythology that's showing up around the world in very similar forms, which, you know, since over time they got more separate and then could evolve and change more on their own, but inherently they're all very similar. Paradise is the most common mythical theme around the world. This is, of course, the Garden of Eden. Thank you, Google Images. And the similarities around the world: people lived like gods, people had miraculous powers, they were often described as luminous or able to fly or perform miracles, not subject to disease and old age, they keep a youthful appearance, live in harmony with nature, had abundant food, did not hunt or eat the animals, perfect weather, and perfect communication, one language for everybody, and living in harmony without wars and discord. And, you know, Garden of Eden is not the only one. That's all around. Now, there are some ancient structures that have been found. And Göbekli Tepe, if that's how you say it. Mm-hmm. Is that in Turkey? I forget. And I believe this is the oldest extensive structure that's been found, and I don't have the date, but it's in this range.
It's around 10,000 BC.
Yeah, so that's Satya Yuga descending. And it's not just a cave or a rough hut or something like that you would figure out for people just learning to build stuff. It was a whole temple complex. We have more of these. There's another picture. There's an artist representation of it being built. And it seems to have been in use for about 1,500 years, so through a big chunk of Satya Yuga. And then interestingly, as far as they can tell, it was deliberately buried. And, you know,
very
why
unusual.
Would you... why would you do this? But if you're in Satya Yuga, you're probably aware enough to know that you're in descending Satya Yuga. If this temple was in use for 1,500 years, they could probably start to observe the descent. So, did they realize people weren't going to get what they needed out of this temple? Did they want to prevent people who didn't understand it from defiling it? Who knows? But it was in use, and then it stopped. It has also has
it
lots of symbols.
The
they sometimes do, yeah, like labyrinths do. Yeah.
The main reason I think it's a temple is this. They can't find any evidence of any other use.
Yeah.
There's no evidence of it being lived in or cooked in or any other purpose.
Yeah.
So they assume it's...
And there are interesting symbols around it, like these are some examples. And people are like, I don't know, primitive nature gods, who knows? But how much can we really tell from a symbol without knowing what they were doing? You know, if you imagine somebody thousands of years in the future digging up a Christian church and finding an image of Jesus on the cross, and they're like, whoa, what are these horrible people, you know, practicing human torture rituals, you know? If you don't have the background philosophy, you can't interpret these symbols.
The temple complex could have been like a kindergarten project.
Yeah, we still have to work with matter for the kindergartners. Yeah, who knows?
Yeah. Please build these thoughts, these structures, your thoughts.
That picture is probably not how they were actually built either. That's somebody imagining it. I just pulled it in because you could sort of see a little bit more of it without the.
What was that place called? I've never heard of it before.
Göbekli Tepe.
Where is it?
G-O-B-E-K-L-I.
And then T-E-P-E is the second word.
You'll get it.
Yeah, T-E-P-E is the second word. But yeah, if you Google the first word of that.
And if you look at these masters, two incarnations we know about during declining Dwapara, there's not a lot of evidence about their evolution through their housing or their temples. I mean, it doesn't show you reflect on their higher consciousness necessarily with the incarnations in Dwapara. I mean, Yukeshwar's house wasn't like, oh my God.
Yeah, because it was all in this consciousness. Yeah. Cave paintings are also interesting, just because a lot of the things we found have been basically from Satya Yuga and would use pigments and even elements of perspective that were not used again until like the Renaissance. And, you know, we sort of see these and we just kind of go like, ah, whatever, cave paintings, I know that. But people who study it go, you know, this is actually really unusual because this wasn't done again for a long time. There are also these etchings. These, I think, were like chipped like etchings into stone that are also from the same period and show people, you know, wearing clothes, wearing hats, and they get like much more detailed than you typically think about the stick figures on a cave wall. I think this was from the La Marche caves in France, and when they were discovered in the 1930s, the guy who brought them to the, you know, archaeological society or whatever it was, he was laughed out of the room. They said these have to be fake. Like, nobody was doing that 10,000 years ago.
There's also increasingly question around the accuracy of how they can date these things. They're starting to realize that they weren't quite as good at it as they thought, and so a lot of these kind of ancient artifacts could come from a couple yuga cycles ago, you know, especially if they were like deep in a cave or something.
Or the ones carved into rock as opposed to painted, because those would last longer.
Yeah, it's really hard to say when they came from in some cases.
So we get down to Treta Yuga, and we have come out of paradise. And what has to start happening here is we still have tremendous mental power, which gives us power over energy, over matter. But we remember being in absolute paradise, and we have to figure out how to use what we still have to have those kind of experiences. And over the course of Treta Yuga, we'll also start losing our mental communication, which we developed when we were going up. And somewhere in here, Sanskrit was developed. I'm hoping this is Sanskrit. The internet told me it was Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is interesting because it's, you know, linguists who study it say it seems as if it was deliberately created in a short period. And it is also particularly well-suited for expressing spiritual truths, which sounds like, hey, we can all communicate, but this is falling apart. Quick, make a system that will let us communicate with our mouths now instead of our minds, and write it down, for that matter. And what are we still interested in talking about? High spiritual truths. So it's going to have all the right vocabulary for doing that. By tradition, Sanskrit is said to be really in tune with the vibrations of concepts and things, such that, you know, to some extent, the actual literal sound of the word embodies the vibration of whatever you're talking about, which is why we still use Sanskrit mantras, even if we don't speak that as a language.
It also shows evidence of an extremely acute understanding of linguistics, of the actual structure of how our voices work and how they produce sound. That wasn't rediscovered until the 20th century, but it's baked into the design of the alphabetic system and the way they understand it. Their alphabet is written out in a grid exactly the same way that linguists would classify the sounds. Mm-hmm. Rather than being considered A, B, C, D, just writing it in a line, it's a grid. Wow. And it's organized along dimensions that modern linguistics still uses.
Right. So this is an interesting thing about the descending arc. You know, we go, oh, it's kind of sad because we're losing everything. But on the other hand, things that we're creating on at the beginning on our way up from scratch, they're creating from a higher level of consciousness. So, you know, when they create the first language, they're going to do a really good job of it. So there's that, at least. And so this was very attuned to religion and spirituality and there are linguistic connections to Sanskrit and languages all around the world, and also the mythology, like I said, has all the connections, and even specifically the gods, the pantheons of gods. Did I put them here? Here's like just a few, but around. I was having trouble finding really good images of these, but you know, here's just the one set of them from Hinduism, and of course you can make sets like this from all sorts of traditions, because there was actually this awareness at some point, and it was the same around the world, and this is what we used our language to talk about and create, and they gradually changed over time as we forgot the experience and just kept, you know, modifying the words. And in descending Treta Yuga is when we get the Vedas start being written. And the Vedas have a lot of mantras in them, and the word mantra literally means mind tool. And because they're in Treta Yuga, they still know how to work with their mind, with the power of thought, but they can't do or have everything they used to have when they were in paradise. So they develop these tools, this is basically technology, thought technology, to get what they want using what they have. And so they are ways of just bumping yourself back up into that higher Satya Yuga state of consciousness using your abilities now. So it was practical tools. And the interesting thing about this, again, for being descending, is that the practical application came before the theory. You know, people didn't have to work out logical reasons why things should work and then experiment. They know what they're going for and they know how stuff works and they go, okay, here's how you do it. The older Vedas are, the more just impenetrable they are, pretty much. And I think, is this a chronological list? I think it might be with the Rig Veda, the oldest one. And they would get a little more explained or modified as time went on. And then the Upanishads came along and tried to explain all the Vedas, and they were much closer to our time, so we can understand the Upanishads now as far as they go, but we can't use them to have such complete mind power as people in Treta Yuga could have gotten from the original Vedas.
So maybe if you were incarnated then, and you were part of this experience that was happening, and you incarnate now, and you read those, it will like trigger that energetic experience.
Well, maybe. Who knows?
You are,
I mean, if you still have that,
consciousness, you know?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, one of the things we've been mentioning throughout the class is you incarnate on the level that you're ready for. And maybe some of us have already been up to those higher levels and have come back here for a specific reason and would have that. Maybe we haven't even gotten there yet. Who knows? anything is possible.
So Hong Sa suggests that we're to distract the mind. There's really something to it.
That's right. I mean, there's a reason we teach the Hong Sa technique as Hong Sa. We'll use I am spirit or something if we're teaching in a context where people aren't going to go for some Sanskrit mantras. But ideally, we use the Sanskrit one because there is actual power in the mantra.
And another interesting observation is that, you know, if in Satya Yuga you only need telepathy to communicate, in Treta Yuga you begin losing that, right? So
yeah.
You have to develop spoken language. Mm-hmm. But they said that they make the point in the book. I think that the ability to remember things is still incredibly powerful. You can basically memorize anything. you can transmit thoughts to each other, so it's relatively easy. But as you start losing that, you have to develop writing.
Mm-hmm.
So the development of spoken language is an artifact of descent from Satyata Treta, and the development of writing is an artifact of descent from Treta to Dwapara.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it came up in my mind is sort of like in Satya Yuga, you know how Master in his poems Mani says that the universe or creation is the center of
intuitive perception
in his heart. And so I feel like in Satya Yuga, you know, when you communicate to other people, you're really communicating with the essence of you, inside you. So it's one. And then when you get out of Treta Yuga, or before you get to Satya Yuga, it's dual still. You know, so now it's like you have to communicate, you have to use tools to get to one.
Imperfect tools to try and achieve what could be obtained more perfectly in other ages.
So what it says here is, when Treta Yuga man chanted or mentally focused on a mantra with the intuitive attunement natural to him, the mantra would have bestowed on him the inner awareness particular to that mantra. The mantras of the Rig Veda were not therefore ritualistic or magic formulae intended superstitiously to manipulate the outer world, but instead provided a means for Treta Yuga man to manipulate his inner world. Now over time, the Vedas sort of start devolving, and they become more ritualistic. They become more focused on lower goals, more things about, you know, what do you want to happen on a worldly level instead of a spiritual level. The Atharvaveda at the bottom, the dates are fuzzy on all of them, but some people think that one was actually composed in Dwapara Yuga, and it gets much more into, you know, cure my baldness, find me a wife, all these things. That was different than the original ones, which people at that point couldn't understand them anyway. So they were just adapting as best they could to where their consciousness was.
So do you mean they continued to record new Vedas, and that those were evolved from the original?
Yeah, or modifications or variations on them. I'm not a Vedic scholar, so I couldn't really say exactly how that happened. And obviously we still have the original Vedas. It's just at a certain point, people don't know what to do with them. Where they chant the words and it doesn't happen. Between one of these, it might have been from the Rig Veda to the Sam Veda, they said what looked like is it was an adaptation from mental chanting to vocal chanting. You know, things that would actually make it easier to actually pronounce, even though it wasn't precisely what you needed mentally. So there's part of the shift happening as you lose those powers.
And as you move to more towards the Dwapara people interpreting them, they're going to be more interested in things like self-gain and stuff like that. So the nature of the mantras and the rituals that they would begin recording would be more oriented toward the interest of a Dwapara Yuga consciousness.
And maybe so they're adapting what they already had. Maybe they're making it up because it seems like it should work that way. I don't know.
And the energy wouldn't come through because it wasn't coming from Godhead. It was coming from ego.
These aren't recorded in the same time period.
Well, these are mostly Treta Yuga, but there's some thought that the bottom one there was actually Dwapara, early Dwapara. I believe this is chronological, so the oldest one, the Rig Veda, higher up in Treta Yuga. And then they gradually
and
just.
Dwapara
shift.
Is after Treta Yuga.
When you're going this way, coming down, yeah.
When you're coming down.
Yeah.
And so the Yuga before Treta Yuga.
Satya, it's at the top.
Satya,
yeah. And Satya Yuga, they didn't need all this stuff because they're just living in paradise. And here they're adapting, but the way that they're adapting is with mind tools focused on spiritual experiences, which gradually became language tools focused on self-interest. Another thing going on in Treta Yuga descending was there were a lot of sort of ancient observatories, big structures like Stonehenge and things that seemed to relate to astrology. And there are things all over the world, actually. And this is one pulled this one out because it's pretty, and I've actually been there. This is Newgrange in Ireland, and it was dug up in the 1700s, I think. And actually, for 200 years, anybody could actually just walk in there. It was just out there on a hill. Now it's you have to have tours, and it's all very carefully protected. But this is a huge. Basically, it's an observatory. You're sort of going underground when you go inside it because it's mostly completely closed off. Let's see.
So it's sort of like a plot,
but here's where you go in, and but inside, there's sort of a chamber, but then you go through this just like windy little tunnel. Most of that giant mound isn't stuff you can be inside of, but there's like this little opening where, let's see, what is it? On the winter solstice for 17 minutes at dawn, sunlight will come through this opening and fill the whole chamber with light. And just before that, I think you can see Venus in a way that lets you track Venus's 40-year cycle. And I think there are a couple other things with this also that was basically like, why did people go to such great lengths? People like to talk about Stonehenge, like, oh, they can find the equinox and know when to plant their crops. Okay, well, how does Venus's 40-year cycle help you with this? Mm-hmm. And we don't really have exact answers, but people were starting to get very interested in tracking these astrological influences on the world that they probably used to be able to just perceive. And now they can't, so they're building things to help them get this information that's very important to them. And so this started, this is probably like the bottom of Treta Yuga descending, and it went on into Dwapara. And it's interesting that through a lot of our more recent history, people have assumed that science would sort of kick out astrology and take over as being something more accurate and more useful. But there's actually a lot of interest in astrology still, even today. And maybe even more so, especially as we get more subtly attuned to the energy of it and can really take it seriously and not just horoscopes in a newspaper. And the authors of this book speculate that it may be a particularly Dwapara Yuga kind of a science, astrology, because we're at this level where we can tell that the energy is coming from planets and stars affect us, but we can't perceive it directly, so we have to figure out how to observe and chart all these things. And so a lot of these kind of structures were built during this time, end of Treta Yuga, beginning of Dwapara Yuga. So we're coming down to Dwapara Yuga here, and let's see if we can get through it before the end of class. I think we're going to make it all the way around 24,000 years and 3 hours. And again, this is the same slide we saw coming up, but we're on the downward side now. And what we start seeing archaeologically in Dwapara Yuga is cities start to evolve. And cities are motivated by commerce. The more people you have around to trade with, the more you can get what you want, because Dwapara Yuga is self-interested and looking out for the individual. So there's the self-interest motivating commerce, motivating cities. And so things start popping up all around the world. Again, kind of at the same time. And people are like, wow, how did they do that when they weren't even communicating and like all at the same time? Well, because consciousness is starting at the same time. And actually we all have, they were communicating up to a certain point in Treta Yuga because they could just do it with their minds. Here's one of them, Mohenjo-Daro, just a sort of outline of a map of what's been excavated. So they get these complex civilizations.
Where is this?
And where is Mohenjo-Daro?
Not
it's Middle East somewhere.
Is it in Sri Lanka?
Is it?
I don't remember.
Okay.
What's the name of the river? Sindhu River, that certainly
Oh, yeah, that's the Sindhu River. But the point is there are a bunch of these, and traditional archaeology takes the view that, like, oh, all of a sudden we figured out how to domesticate animals and have organized agriculture and get along well enough to come together in cities and develop commerce. From the Yuga's point of view...
And they view that as an improvement.
As an improvement.
Because it's more like us
from the Yuga's point of view, yeah, of course, it matches us, it must be good. Yeah. But if you're thinking about Treta Yuga man, who came down from paradise, and even after paradise, was able to use his thought power to manifest what he needed, why would they want to live in big, messy, noisy, smelly cities when they could just have, you know, beautiful, open, intentional communities like Ananda Village and manifest what they need through their mantras? But as that got harder and harder, you needed more and more help, and you need more and more people to come together. It's like, oh yeah, like we better start doing this on a big scale. Like we knew how to raise crops, we knew how to domesticate animals, but now we're putting this all together.
There's also more boundaries between people and their environment, and people and other people. Like,
yeah. And ironically, gathering into these big cities now, but you know those are all walls in there also. And we've already lost the direct mental communication, so that's sort of a boundary there, having to use words. I mean, thank goodness we never lost language entirely through Kali Yuga. It could have been a lot worse.
We almost did, because there was such a proliferation of different languages that you couldn't understand people from other places. That's the Tower of Babel.
Yeah, the Tower of Babel.
Is that, like, we used to have one language and now we don't? Like, yeah. What happened?
And what the book says is that recent scholarship has traced the first instance of this myth, the confusion of tongues, the Tower of Babel, to the reign of Peleg in Mesopotamia around 3000 BC. Which is, look, there's 3100 BC at the right of the border there, Treta coming into Dwapara. So that's interesting. And within a span of 5 centuries, which is the 2 transition periods, 300 for Treta Yuga and 200 for Dwapara, mankind went from a single universal, probably mostly mental language, though they had the written Sanskrit also, of thoughts, images, and symbols to many separate spoken languages. So they're losing thought control as a power, but they're still at the top of Dwapara Yuga, so they have a lot better energy control than we have now, and subtle energy, like life force energy, not, you know, this relatively gross electricity sort of energy. And that's their fallback position when they can't just use their mental power, is to use the energy to control and manipulate the world around them. But they're not doing this coming from a position like we are of having physical stuff and building technology, physical things. They're using pure life force to affect the world. What would that look like to us if we saw it now? I had to put Harry Potter in here. Like, magic! This is where the tradition, you know, and the stories of magic throughout the world come from. And one of the things I always noticed about myself, you know, I've loved reading fantasy and sci-fi all my life, and I think part of it is because part of me inherently knows we are capable of a lot more, and these books let us imagine that. And basically, high Dwapara descending was using magic, because they didn't have enough stuff to manipulate with the energy they were coming down. And how they were using it from a higher level.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
What's the explanation in the Bible of the confusion of the languages? Mm-hmm. What, do you know that?
Well, the Tower of Babel story says that they were trying to do some big project together that was too presumptuous.
The tower to reach to the heavens.
Yeah, and so God basically said, you're not going to be able to do this. And
thwarted them
by giving everyone a different language, and they all couldn't understand each other, so they all dispersed. That's essentially the summary of it, right?
So they're basically doing foolish things.
So they were presuming to be godlike.
They were
overreaching.
Yeah, so they were in Treta coming down, so they were using technology in a very bad way.
They were trying to use technology to be godlike.
And it wasn't really, it's not very technical. Not what we would call technology, because they weren't so much working with stuff. The stuff was very basic.
But remember, this myth is a myth that probably developed during lower, or mid to lower Dwapara, trying to think back to try and explain what happened 2,000 years prior.
When they can no longer.
From a much lower perspective, right. You know, an ability to understand what happened. That's how they explain it to themselves,
right.
Of what happened at that point.
Like from a place of ego identification.
Yeah.
And maybe there was some incident with some tower or some project that, and who knows what the original thing was, but at least the way the story, because to some extent it turned into a story, and to some extent it's probably literal, and that
might be a literal component.
Parsing a part is probably lost to us at this point. Yeah. But
well, that makes so much, explains so much, like, because if they're like in ego identification and they're trying to explain why we don't have those abilities anymore, like there's some sort of perception they have, like that used to exist. We used to be in the Garden of Eden or the, you know, the whatever Adam and Eve thing, kind of like explains how. You know what I mean?
It's another one of those myths with the pattern
that is from
a lower descending time trying to explain what happened in a higher time.
So
but they can't understand it very well.
Right,
you know,
and then you get these stories about, like, God was punishing us because we tried to.
And that's what it would seem like.
We ate the apple, you know, the whole thing.
If you know that you were closer to God before and now you're not, you try to come up with reasons for why it might have happened.
And if you're in that,
why did this happen?
Childhood sort of thinking, everything is my fault. Like, it's sort of like the way in psychology they talk about the development of from childhood and up to, you know, adulthood, and how children are, think the world revolves around them, and so if anything happens, it's their fault, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and then
that,
their awareness expands.
It's like the
Buddhist
version of that.
Other realities.
Yeah. Wow, that's really interesting.
So it seems to have happened quickly, though.
Well, and
that
story of the Tower of Babel captures that as a single incident.
Right.
And but what we actually observed is that it happened quickly and right around the time of the change of the yugas, when suddenly we just could not rely on thought communication anymore, and we had to be shifting into these languages. And the languages can develop differently in different parts of the world because we're not as instantaneously connected with each other anymore. On this theme of magic, there's the story of Moses and Aaron coming before the Pharaoh, telling him to free the Israelites, and Moses or Aaron, one of them, turns his staff into a snake, and the response from the Pharaoh is not to go like, "Whoa, witchcraft! Oh, this is crazy! How did you do this? What's the trick?" His response was to call in his magicians, who turned their staffs into snakes, and fought the first snake, and the first snake won. There was no discussion in here of, like, is this even possible? What's going on? Was this a trick? It was, we use our energy in this way that we now call magic, but we have these abilities, and Moses's was greater than the Pharaoh's court magician's ability was. And this is just how this worked out. There's also the symbology that the snake, of course, can be the kundalini energy, which is our life force energy inside us. It's often symbolized by a snake. Maybe that's why he chose it. Maybe he could have turned his staff into anything. I don't know.
the
snakes fighting.
Remember, because it involves snakes.
Again, it could very well have changed and whatnot over the years, but it was just an example, and it's interesting for the fact that it just happened. It's like it was accepted because that's how things worked at that time period.
Oh, the snakes.
So that just shows them all pitting their snakes against
each
other.
It's like an everyday thing.
It's like our TV. You bring a Kali Yuga person in here and show them TV, it's like witchcraft, but it's normal for us because we're used to energy applied to matter in that way that we call technology. This was their technology. So the pyramids, it's our continuation from, what I was saying about, building all the observatories and descending Treta. They actually, and the foundations, the original buildings at this site were in Treta Yuga, but the main pyramids that we know today were in Dwapara Yuga. That's when they were created. And it's a good example of applying high level of consciousness and energy, but still not having a lot of, but not being very technological on the material plane, because again, there's a much smaller population. They don't have just that infrastructure to do fancy stuff. It shows just exquisite construction in mathematics, in the energy, but it's all made out of just stone. you know, there's no fancy metals or circuits or anything. It's just stone. But they could do very, very amazing things just with the stone.
There's increasing evidence that they are technological things, that it wasn't a temple, it wasn't a spiritual thing necessarily, but it was like a technology, or maybe a spiritual technology,
right.
But it's not a temple. It's not a tomb. It's, you know, like,
you know,
it's been interpreted later.
I had a friend who, he had like had 100 patents for IBM, and then he got into, he was a crystallologist, he was an expert in this field, and then he got into pyramids, and realized, so he started making these crystals, called Vogel crystals, his name is Marcel Vogel, and he realized he could measure with all his instrumentation, his complicated instrumentation that he invented, that it would channel the energy more intensely if it had a termination on one of the ends that was pyramid shaped and might have facets, it might have 13 or 12, but if it was pyramid shaped, it was much more effective. And so he got thrown out of the community, the scientific community, until he proved that was true through his instrumentation he invented.
We had a thing at East West that we used to sell that was a copper frame that was in a pyramid shape that you hung from the ceiling and could sit under and meditate under or whatever. A lot of people really loved them. That guy stopped making them, so we don't have them anymore. An interesting thing about the pyramids, just back on the astrology line, you know, because astrology is kind of a Dwapara thing, they line up almost perfectly with the stars of Orion's belt, and it's been calculated that they probably did line up exactly perfectly at about peak Satya Yuga, about 11,000 something BC. So that's just interesting.
And the relative sizes of them correspond to the relative brightnesses of those three stars.
Yeah. So.
I thought they've been aged at 5,000 years BC.
There's no real evidence for that. That's based on assumptions that are based on the old paradigm. So.
They're faces are lined up to the energy axis of the planet, like the north and south axis, the east and west axis of the planet Earth on an energetic level, perfectly aligned.
Yeah.
Some people are starting to think that they might have been used for some sort of telepathy. What's the word? No, like augmenter. So like you could go in and it would amplifier, like a telepathy amplifier.
Okay.
And you could go into the central chamber and like use it as a broadcasting station. By when Dwapara Yuga is descending, or Treta Yuga is descending, you can't instantly communicate telepathically with the rest of the world, but maybe there's a technology that helps you do it for a couple more thousand years than you otherwise would have been able to do.
Hopefully you have integrity if you're in there.
That's the development of a priest class, right? Because if you have technology now, it has to be used wisely, so you have to start limiting it to the idea of more capable or more trusted.
But you have less of a direct perception of who that is, so it starts turning into a hereditary thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They also picture all the continents that they're squished together before they separated. The Great Pyramids right in the middle of all the land mass. Mm-hmm.
You mean it's at that location that would have been the center at one time?
So, and of course, one of the other interesting questions about the pyramid is how they made it, which, you know, most Kali Yuga concepts that have come up through our history are just ridiculous when you apply it to something like this. And there are a lot of other things in the ancient world that were similar. So this is something, I think this is also in Turkey. The strongest tower crane that we make today can lift 265 tons. And this stone here, 900 tons. And those guys down there, 400 tons. You know, we couldn't lift those with anything today. This is one that didn't come out of the earth, but you see that person there? See that little person standing in front of it? That's how big that is. That's probably bigger than the other ones. And obviously they didn't finish there, but what were they planning to do with that one? But, you know, because they didn't have this physical technology, like we still think we have to build something, and we can use electricity and gas and fossil fuels and whatever to make it move. But at that point, they were still working on what we would call magic, but direct application of energy. And, you know, were there people who were especially trained in changing the energy of that material so that it was suddenly very light and you could just push it into place. Were there people who could just, you know, levitate it as if with a magnet using energy and move it over there?
It's said that there are sound vibration techniques you can use to move large stones. And I have a friend who is associated with the Hindu temple monastery in Kauai, and they're building a traditional Hindu temple there with all traditional techniques. And she said she personally observed that the monks, there was a landscaping moving day where they had to reshape some areas of the land in order to fit the overall plan. She observed the monks using sound techniques to lift giant boulders and move them.
Were they like chanting at it or what?
Yeah, mantras.
Wow.
So they moved the giant boulders with mantras.
And of course, mantras are what turned into what we call magic spells, things like that. You can sort of see how this changes in our consciousness. But wow.
Well, people get your mantras mixed up.
And here's another Moses thing. This is Moses gained the Ten Commandments. We're heading down towards Kali Yuga. Things have to be more fixed. You have to have more rules. What does he find? He finds everybody worshiping the golden calf and partying. And because we're in Dwapara, it's descending. People are getting more self-interested. Like, what can religion do for me? Can this, if I worship a golden calf, will I be rich? Do I want to follow all these commandments Moses just brought down? So things are starting to shift here, and again, unfortunately, in that direction, but we're not there anymore. Some other interesting things. The Sushruta Samhita is a medical compendium from, this is descending Dwapara Yuga. Sushruta was, I think, a person who was an actual doctor of some sort, and it describes so many types of illnesses and medicines and surgeries, including plastic surgery, cataract surgery, C-sections, and also has mantras and things that look just more woo-woo to us because they had that, they had all those ways of dealing with these things. It shows very, very detailed medical knowledge on par with what we know today, but also different ways of achieving those things.
What is that first picture?
That's probably a statue of the guy.
Of that guy?
Yeah, Sushruta. Known as the father of surgery there. Mm-hmm. This is just one of the things I found on Google, so I didn't make this slide. So there we are, coming down to the bottom of Dwapara Yuga. And you can just imagine, like, now they've been using their magic, whatever they called it, it's their technology, and it's just starting to work less and less. And it's like, you know, we come into our houses, and every once in a while, the lights just don't turn on. And then after a while, they never turn on. And then our car works for a little while, and sometimes it stalls a bit more often than it used to, and then one day it just doesn't work anymore. And people have forgotten to fix these things, and you know, we would just be falling back into Kali Yuga and, okay, well, we just have to work with this stuff we can actually do with our hands ourselves now. And that's what was happening to them, losing their energy technology and coming down into Kali Yuga. And I find it interesting that I read a lot, and the genre of fiction that's really big these days that I've kind of burned out on is post-apocalyptic fiction. People just like imagining what happens if we do blow up everything and have to just start from scratch. And I wonder if it's because we're still so early in Dwapara that there's this resonance with that end of Dwapara when they did lose everything and they had to figure out how to deal with the material world. I don't know, that just connected in my head, so I said it, but it may be something. Yes?
So they're coming down, and then Jesus came.
Because we need avatars anytime we can get them, yeah. He had to keep something going.
He came
spiritually.
Right at the bottom?
Yeah, he came almost right at the bottom, 500 years before the bottom. Yep. We have, that's 500 AD at the very bottom. So he was towards the end. He was middle of Kali Yuga descending. Yeah. So it was pretty bad.
So he needed him as bad as any time.
Yeah, we always need our avatars. And it's sort of for those who have ears to hear, as he himself said. You know, not everybody could handle it, but it kept something going on the planet that was spiritual. And it, but think how matter-oriented it was. We had to literally kill his body, and he had to bring that body back for people to believe that there was something really going on there. That's how physical it was. Yogananda didn't have to get nearly that dramatic because we could relate to him on a more subtle level more easily. But the masters just, they do what needs to be done for the people at the time, you know, when they're here.
And it's probably not inconceivable that Jesus didn't incarnate other times that we're not aware of, where it's not so visible.
Yeah, I mean, if they can come back once, they can come back many times. And Yogananda told us that he was Arjuna, and Babaji was Krishna, and Lahiri was, who was Lahiri? He was a few other people.
Yogananda was Arjuna?
Yogananda was Arjuna. And Swami Kriyananda has floated the idea that, you know, a lot of avatars kind of seem to pop up a lot if you connect their incarnations. Oh, Yogananda was Adi Shankaracharya, I think.
And Yogananda said that Jesus and John the Baptist were Elijah and Elisha.
Yeah, and so Swami Kriyananda has sort of proposed, like, I wonder if there's kind of a group of avatars who are kind of in charge of this planet and just keep checking in every so often to make sure we're still okay. And thank goodness, thank you, we need everything we can get.
They come once or twice per year to tweak things.
Yeah, yeah. And so just for the last couple minutes, I'll just mention something. This was one cycle of 24,000 years, but it keeps going, you know, multiple. Yogananda said that civilized man has existed on Earth for over 50 million years, which would be many, many of these cycles. Now, most, you know, scientists, archaeologists, anthropologists would not agree with that today. But in the early 1900s, the oldest known human fossils were believed to be about 200,000 years old, which is very little. Now, we put some of them at about 3.2 million years old. So, you know, we keep finding out new things and changing our estimates. So is 50 million really out of the question? Who knows? There's also the question of, you know, when we find these fossils, who was human or not, like Lucy, Australopithecus africanus, the Neanderthals, the Cro-Magnons, you know. Lucy was very small, but, you know, we have small children who are prodigies. Why couldn't Lucy have been at a Satyayuga time, but and very advanced spiritually, but just in a small body? Who cares? You know, these are just bodies. It could change over time evolutionarily or for whatever other reasons. Neanderthals used to be thought more of a separate species, and now it seems like they're really pretty much 99% like same as us.
You know, Bud brought up this panspermia idea that, you know, our bodies that happen to be dominating the planet now in this form could be sort of been seeded here by other more intelligent or other beings that were able to physically, you know, manipulate the genetics. And that could have been going on starting 50 million years ago, and what the dominant form looked like could have changed many times during that time period.
Yeah, and we just...
You said there were humans, you know, they said there were human equivalents, you know, on the planet for 50 million years. So.
Yeah.
And it's important to note that this is the backdrop to the real story. And the real story is an individual, liberation.
Yeah.
Right? So this is sort of like the setting for the work that one person, one soul is doing.
On the left side. Stay on the left side.
And going back to her comment about, like, have we been in the higher yugas and do we remember at some level? And I think so. I think maybe I was sort of like on the low range of some of the higher yugas, not quite.
Yeah.
But there was something that I learned there that allows me today to be able to bridge the gap between. There are a lot of people who just cannot even entertain these concepts.
Yeah.
And then, you know, to be at a point where I'm open to the possibility, then I think that does come from having some experience in prior lives to something that was bigger.
Because we're part of a mission now that is really starting a new thing for a new age, and it might have helped to bring back people who have a little experience a little farther along in the path to come back here and get something pushed up from this end. And other times, we will need more of a stretch, and we'll be put somewhere that's more advanced beyond us. And yeah, that can only be answered at an individual level and only by you or if one of these guys shows up and tells you, not in a class. But yeah, it's just what we feel.
Forgotten that there's probably a soul.
We have karmic groups and families.
This, you know, it's like you have not just the seemingly serendipitous satsang group that appears. It's like perhaps the soul group has been together.
We've all lived together many times before. We're all doing this here now. And Master said you cannot be close to anybody in this life unless you've been with them before, because you don't build up those close relationships just in one lifetime. You know, it's always coming on something. Yes.
So what should we do on a day-to-day life?
Meditate.
All Yogananda's teachings.
Yeah. Yeah, this is less of a what to do class. Yeah. I mean, knowing the general flow is good because as we went up, you know, I was pointing out, affirmations, that's straight to you, good consciousness. You know, all these things, how they do relate now, because we want to strive for Satya-yuga consciousness even now. Most of everything else we do at Ananda will be more specifically what to do. This is kind of fun just for the great big picture. You don't strictly need it to be on the spiritual path. You know, you can sit down, meditate, and do everything else and never know about the yugas and do great. But I think it's fun, and it's neat to zoom out once in a while and really look at a big picture.
Somebody talked about Yogananda being the avatar for Dwapara Yuga. And it comes towards the beginning of the yuga, and the stuff he's teaching us now is the best way to get through the next 2,000 years. When he comes again, he'll be giving different teachings that are more subtly oriented towards the time when he comes. Like any avatar will be doing that, right?
I mean, he created energization exercises for us as his new contribution to the yogic science and techniques.
Yeah, right at that time.
And then Christ came right before Kali, and so the sign of, you know, I can't remember how it's, but the sign that's related, the astrological sign that's related to Kali Yuga or that epic was, is the Pisces. So the consciousness, Pisces. So the consciousness of Pisces. And so now we're shifting from Kali to Dwapara, and the new sign is Aquarius. So this is the sign of Aquarius. And Aquarius is about energy and technology and abstract thinking, but it's about that unity through diversity. Unity through diversity. So knowing that we can find the perception of God inside ourselves, but we don't have to look the same outside. So there can be, you can find unity through diversity, and so that's the sign of Aquarius. And, Deepak Chopra? His son is a filmmaker, I think, and he did a documentary on his dad. He wasn't a big fan of his dad, and was kind of didn't appreciate how people just fell on his feet, you know, and just really adored him. And he's like, yeah, you should see him at home, and you know, all he had were all these negative ideas about his dad. So he followed him for a year, and he would film him where he was supposed to be meditating, but he was actually sleeping, so he would film him so that people would see, you know, the real side of Deepak. And so this is really good documentary. So then he goes through this, but then towards the end, he's starting to see what the other people are seeing in his dad, so he kind of comes and makes the shift. And at the end of the movie, so his idea of his dad is that he's very egocentric, that it's all about him and his persona, and people just can't see that. And then towards the end of the movie, almost to the end, he says, how do you want to be remembered? Or how do you think you will be remembered? And he said, I'm part of the transition team. And I thought, that's beautiful. That is absolutely
that's
beautiful.
That's what we are.
Because that's what we light workers are. Yeah, we're part of the transition team.
So that brings us back to right where we are, which is right where we started, which is a good place because it's 2 minutes after one. So the class is officially over because we like to respect time. If people want to hang out and chat, that's cool. Maybe down in the boutique instead of up here. But thank you.
Thank you.
That was a lot of fun.